Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 21st, and you're listening to the best, most thought-provoking, moderately controversial podcast in the whole wide world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. I think you got your adverbs switched there.
Maybe. I'll let them decide and send another 75 post-forum note about it. But go ahead. Let's get the show moving.
Far more controversial than mildly, it seems like now. Not sure about the thought-provoking part, but we'll try our best. We're redoubling our efforts this week.
So, despite being on the road, you still found plenty of time to chat back and forth with numerous people on the forum and with me. So now that you're back, how are things going?
Good. I had this little quickie trip. I went down to South Florida, really just for one night, but I hit as many poker rooms down there as I could. I think I actually hit all of them, but one of them on
wow.
this trip. Just pretty impressive for
pretty crazy.
A little more than 24 hours there. It's tough to do. And to sit there and gab like I like to do with these people, you know.
Yeah.
I can't just go in and shake hands and say, hi, how's it going? All right, see you later. But I thought this trip got started off on an interesting note. I mean, one, I got our show notes done early, and you're like, you know what? I think you're probably going to find some banter items to talk about on the trip. And no sooner did I get off of the Greyhound of the Sky, Spirit Airlines, than banter started coming to me.
Yep. I knew it.
I went to the, got in line to get my rental car, and which, by the way, I thoroughly examined this time. And you put a note on it, garage too dark for me to properly assess damage. So, it's like a get out of jail free card, right?
I guess.
And you also, you know what I remembered? When I returned it, it was wet.
Oh, yeah.
That was our big mistake in San Jose.
Yes.
We'll talk about that later on. So, I'm in the line, there's another guy in front of me, and he turns around, and he sees my shirt, it says Ante Up, and he's like, Ante Up, a poker magazine. And I'm like, yes, it is. And so we start talking about poker a little bit, and the guy was really gregarious, funny guy, real nice guy. So I don't want anything that I'm going to say after this to think that I'm picking on this guy. But he's just, an average Joe that's out there in the world and taking in everything out there. He's not a poker player at all, right?
Right.
He's aware of it, and I think that's interesting what he said to me as we continue talking. And he made this point about how, it used to be that we had to look up to all these jerks on pro sports. Now we have to look up to these jerks on the poker on TV, And then he went off to say, and he's like, he said this quote, there's not one poker player I've seen on TV that I'd invite over to my house.
Oh, my God.
Then he went on to say, like, Ocho Cinco? Sure. But not one poker player. So he was saying that he would be fine letting Chad Ocho Cinco over to his house, and I'm not making any judgments on Chad Ocho Cinco, but I think it's fair to say he's fairly controversial, right?
Yeah, moderately.
Right, and he would rather have him come over to his house than any poker player he's ever seen on TV. And so, again, I just kept continuing to duck it up. I did all about, yeah, sure, whatever. Because I'm not going to get into a fist fight at the Advantage car lane. And he was a nice guy. He was just speaking his mind. But that made me think, I really think we as poker players have a lot more work to do in this public relations campaign than even I thought we did. When average Joes who seem to be nice guys and watch it on TV still think every poker player on TV is a big jerk.
So let me ask you now, this guy, it sounded like he didn't really know anything at all about poker. So, or does he actually get enough of it that he knows?
I'm sure he's one of these kitchen table, plated in college or in the army kind of guys. So, it's not that he doesn't know anything, but certainly he's not a fan of it. Certainly not a fan of the televised, you know, the series and the pros endorsement. Oh, I mean, he's not into all that, obviously, if that's what you're asking.
All right, so in other words, he doesn't watch it. So if he doesn't watch it, then how does he know if he wants people at his house then? Right.
Well, I mean, he's just making, you know, hey, I watch one episode of Jersey Shore, and I already know I don't want Snooki anywhere near Florida, but it's my house. You know, it's the same thing, I think. You know, it doesn't, you don't, there's no statue of, you know, a litmus test here where you're, hey, you can't say that, sir, unless you've watched 12 episodes of the World Series.
Right. No, I'm just saying I can't take him seriously if he's watched one episode of television and saw the one where Tony G, you know, flips out on Howard Lederer or something. You know, I mean, okay, yeah, I don't want that guy in my house either when he's acting like that. But if you watch enough of the shows, you know, Tony G's not as bad as he sounds. You know, I don't know.
No, I understand what you're saying, but I mean, there's a difference between you can't take him seriously and I think you have to take him seriously. And your point is a good one is, you know, it's not a big enough statistical sample that this guy has incurred from your point of view and our point of view to make an accurate assessment of whether poker players are jerks or not. But it doesn't matter because he's made that decision anyhow, and lots of other people probably have. So I guess that's what I'm saying is, I mean, there's no – when people mount a PR campaign, it's not to, hey, you know, people should know better than this. It's because, hey, I know people should know better than this, but they don't, and I want to tell them.
Well, I think this guy is a perfect example of the reason why you don't use him as the litmus test, because he's watched just enough to get himself in trouble to say something stupid like that rather than someone who is totally oblivious to poker and still saying it. If someone has no clue about what poker players are doing, whether it's legal or illegal, and then they come up to you and say, oh, poker? I don't really know what that is, or I've never really watched it on TV, but I wouldn't have anybody over my house. Then we're in trouble. But if some guy has had enough of an impression of poker by playing with some people and watching it on TV a little bit and maybe catching an episode where someone's freaking out and then says it, yeah, okay, well, that guy doesn't – I think he's the person we shouldn't be doing the test with. It's the people who have no idea about poker who may be doing the voting. Those are the ones that I'm worried about. You know, this guy is just mouthing off because he wants to make a conversation with you because you have a shirt and he wants to be cool.
Right. Well, yeah. No, I'm not disagreeing with that. But, I mean, you know, this is the kind of guy when he gets to go with his buddies at the bar and, you know, ESPN's on the background and they say, yeah, you know, poker, I wouldn't want any of those people in my house. And then the buddy goes, yeah, you know what, you're right. And then it continues and it's I don't want to say it's unjustified. Everybody has their own opinion. And actually, I have another. The next question is, you know, what this guy is seeing something we should be concerned about? Because I would say, you know, I'm not going to tell some guy he's wrong if he thinks that most poker players on TV come off as jerks.
Right.
And there's a difference between come off and really is because of the editing and things like that, just like reality show people. I mean, I don't think any of those people are as rotten as they look like when you see the finished product.
Right.
But, I mean, I think it's fair to say that poker players by nature have egos, right?
Mm-hmm.
And act a way on television that does not endear themselves to the masses, though not necessarily obnoxious or rude or not acceptable for a dinner invitation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. What I'm thinking, too, is that I'm sure you're going somewhere with this. Like, when you're talking about do we have more work to do with our – I'm trying to figure out – how are you going to fix that? It's not fixed.
Well, yeah, yeah. No, and I'm not mounting any kind of Occupy Poker Street campaign here or anything. But I think it's just kind of the aggregate. When we're out there talking about poker and, you know, whether we're going to get an online regulator where we're going to get more casinos allowed in different places or poker to expand to states like, you know, Tennessee where it's not now. It's just that aggregate thinking that, you know, once people's minds change and they come to accept poker as something legitimate and not harmful, that's when all those advances make. And to me, I guess it was just a little shocking to hear this guy who seemed like a nice guy, who had watched enough of poker to know about it, say that Chad Ochocinco is better than anybody he's seen on TV. That to me, that's a worry. And I think it's a worry not because of this particular guy. I mean, I'll never see this guy again, I don't think, although he lives in Tampa, so maybe I'll run into him. Maybe he's listening to the show right now and he's ready to kick me. So I'm not really worried about that so much. I'm just worried about the aggregate population. And, you know, when we go door-to-door, per se, to get poker expanded, having people say, yeah, you know, I watched it on TV once and those guys are all jerks. I don't want poker anywhere near me. That's my point, I think.
No, I know. And I know what your point is. I don't know what could possibly be done about that. And are we actually trying to, you know, improve ourselves, our reputations to get all this done? Or are we just trying to say, hey, it's our money? And I mean, you know, if I wanted to go into the bar that this guy was in with his friends and say, I'd watch all these idiots getting drunk and say, you know what, I don't want anybody who drinks alcohol in my house. Prohibition, you know. So, I mean, it's just, it's so, it's such a hard thing to.
Yeah, it's not a tangible thing. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's difficult. But I think there's been a movement. I mean, I think if you could ask people in the 60s and the 70s about poker players versus today, I think it's probably more positive, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, there's been progress, and then there hasn't been any, I don't think, any official movement to get that progress. I mean, obviously, the world has progressed as well, too. So, but I do think it's on some people's minds of trying to cast poker in general, or, you know, I mean, a good point is, you know, that there was somebody, some boy, somewhere, I don't know when it was, 10, 15 years ago, decided in the industry not to call it gambling anymore and call it gaming.
Right.
Because gaming is less threatening. It makes it sound like it's entertainment, not risk-taking.
Yep.
And while a lot of people still call it gambling, but I think that gaming has kind of caught wind a little bit, and it does help. I mean, it's kind of a subliminal PR kind of thing. And I don't know what, you know, obviously there's not a big unified poker agency out there trying to do this stuff. It's just players individually or folks like us in the media that need to, you know, be careful with how we phrase things, how we talk about things to people that aren't in the click, I guess.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And we do need some sort of PR kind of campaign manager type of guy out there trying to help spin things more positively, especially with all the crap that happened with the Black Friday and everything. But, yeah, to say every single player that this guy's ever seen on TV playing poker is second to Ocho Cinco is pretty damn funny.
Yeah, but, I mean, I didn't want to go there necessarily, and I wasn't trying to lead you there, but you did mention, I mean, I guess this is what I was talking about for the whole PR campaign of the U.S. attorney is, you know, he's playing into these guys' fear. There's a guy here, again, nice guy. I certainly don't think he would harm anyone, but he's watched poker and decided he doesn't like these people, and then he hears, oh, guess what? Online poker is a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
Those two things together, in his mind, you know, there's no reason for him to defend poker at that point. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And that's what's dangerous, I think. So it's not so much that we don't have a PR campaign, it's that other people have a PR campaign against us, and we're losing that fight.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now that we started the show on a downer, there's no hope for poker ever again anymore. Let's ride it out for the rest of the show and enjoy it. all right, so you know I was down in South Florida, and as people probably know from listening to the show, I'm travel challenged. I think I told this story before. One of the last times I was down there, I went to the toll booth, remember? And I didn't have an exact change, and then I found exact change, and I dropped it between the seat, blah, blah, blah. Well, no more. Apparently I missed this, but in South Florida, everything has gone to pay by plate down there now. Unless you have the little SunPass transponder where you can like zip right through. Now everybody zips right through. They take a picture of your license plate and they send you a bill.
What?
For the 75
hell?
Cents.
Now, oh my God.
Sounds kind of crazy, but I mean, I enjoyed zipping through that thing and not sitting there waiting and not trying to cobble together the three quarters. And of course, that's on a rental car, so I'm waiting to see how that all works. I assume I'm going to get a bill for $1.25 on my credit card here in a week or two. But it's highly efficient, and I just haven't seen it anywhere before, I guess. Well, and I'm a little surprised that I did hear about it.
It's highly efficient in the sense that, well, you can drive right through, but is it highly efficient for, like, the economy? I mean, they got to mail something to you, and all the extra legwork, instead of just having you put $1.25 in someone's hand, they're saving that much money?
Oh, but think about the human labor, having people sit there at the toll booths.
Oh, no, I know about the human labor, but for the most part,
a letter for 44 cents.
They could put a machine in with a credit card, too, or something. You know what I mean? There's a million ways to pay your toll without a person there.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. But, I mean, this way solves both the problem of slowing people down and cost savings.
More postage, I guess. They got to mail it to everybody.
Well, yeah, but I think that's still less than putting a credit card
in. That also sucks, too. What if somebody borrows my car? Now I get billed? Now I got to go find the person that borrowed my car?
Better let them know that you need to sign a credit agreement.
You didn't even know about it. You didn't even know about it. I didn't know about it. If you didn't bring it up on the show, I might have let somebody borrow my car who goes through one of these things, and all of a sudden I get a bill for $17 for because they drove all the way to the Keys in my car, and I didn't know it. And I, this is stupid, man. I hate that idea. Absolutely hate it.
Well, it's good to know that you're going to let people borrow your car and drive all the way to the Keys.
Well, I might. I mean, I don't know.
Might.
There's so many people out there who might do that.
It's a possibility. Somebody can put a gun to my head. I'm like, sure, go to the Keys.
It's not my... I mean, you know, just in general, there's people out there who say, hey, you can borrow my key and go my car and go across the country or whatever. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I don't like that.
It is.
I don't like it at all.
All right, but the overall point of the trip was to visit some friends down there and see some new stuff. And, you know, I've said this before the show, and at this point, it's getting harder and harder to dispute the fact that South Florida is the most competitive poker market in the United States, perhaps probably the world, and I can't say the world because I haven't traveled the world, but certainly I think of the places that we've been together or I've been on my own. I think it's really hard pressed to say that there's a more competitive market than South Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about LA, which we talked about in last week's show, you know, some of these other markets that we're going to talk about on the couple shows. I mean, it's certainly strongly competitive, but South Florida, absolutely cutthroat at this point, and it's only going to get worse. You know, I went down there really just kind of on a lark, and I end up learning how much more is happening down there. I mean, the last big thing I think we probably mentioned on the show is this whole move to the $2 jackpot rake, as it's the most promotion-happy area in the United States, even more so than elsewhere in Florida.
Yeah.
Really, it's they've created an economy down there where you're essentially renting players. You know, you offer $1,000 high hands on Tuesday, and then the next day, another casino offers $1,000 high hands, so all those players move there, and then they move to the next casino on the next day for $1,000 high hands. And it's really hard to build up loyalty there, despite, you know, how nice your room is and other things that you offer, right?
Yeah.
And here's what's going on now, is I got a little hard hat tour of Seminole Coconut Creek, and I'm getting kind of used to these hard hats, Chris. We had that little tour out in San Jose that we'll talk about a couple weeks, and now this one. I kind of feel like just knocking a wall out of the house just so I have a reason to wear an Annie Up hard hat now, because I look pretty darn good in it.
I think. That's the thing, though. I don't think you've actually seen yourself in the hat, so once you do that, you'll change your mind, because I saw you in the hat, and yeah, I'm here to tell you, and stick with no hats.
All right, okay. But for folks that are familiar with there or aren't familiar with there, Seminole Coconut Creek has had a poker room for quite a while. It's a one of the smaller of the Seminole Six properties.
Right.
But they have added blackjack recently from the compact, and they have embarked on this massive reconstruction of the area, adding a parking garage and a lot of other things. And I knew they were doing some work on the poker room, but I had no idea until I actually got there and saw it. Right now, it's a 10-table poker room, and it really is an afterthought. It's up on the second floor, and it's just kind of hidden away, and it's just there. This new poker room, it's going to be 30 tables. They have this glassed-in VIP one-table room, just one table in it, with like little couches around it, so you can bring your little lap girls or lap boys or whoever comes with you and sit there, and they can watch you play. Because that's exciting. And then like another six-table high brush area. And then one of the more interesting things, they have a bar, a dedicated bar and food service in there, which is nice. But they're going to have two heads-up tables, Chris.
Wow.
Not two tables that they just designate head-up. Two of those little smaller tables, kind of like you used to see on the NBC Heads-Up Championship before it got canceled.
Those are cool.
Yeah, I've just never I haven't seen them anywhere other than that.
No, I mean, I think that that's a good idea, too, because if you want to open up that table for something else, the big one, when it gets the heads up, you know, in a tournament, they can just move it to the smaller table.
That is very true.
You know, and then say, okay, now we got a full table open for another Singo or another tournament or whatever cash game. Not that they'll probably have that problem with 30 tables in the room, but it's something to consider when you need it if you get that busy. So that's kind of cool, too. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, that's actually a good point, because I thought it was cool when he mentioned it, just because of the novelty factor. I'm like, you know, I haven't seen it. And immediately I asked him, like, you know, are these like real tables or not those Poker Pro tables? Which I think would be cool in itself, because I don't think anybody really does those either. But he's like, no, actual real tables. And then I left, and then, you know, I guess I started thinking, how often have we, all this traveling we've done, how often have we seen a heads-up match going on anywhere?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is there a market for it, or is this a market that's untapped because no one's gone to this effort to do it? I mean, when you walk in to a poker room and you see a little table for heads-up, something goes off in your head. Hey, heads up. Maybe I want to play heads up. Whereas if you walk in a poker room where there's no such thing, I don't think you ever think of that, right?
No, I never think of that. I mean, if you see the table, I might put that thought in your head, like you said. But the other thing about it is, I wonder did he tell you what it was for? I mean, I'm wondering what it's for. Because, I mean, you're not really going to surrender a dealer because two guys feel like playing each other unless it's some really big action. Actually, one time it happened to me. It wasn't a heads-up table, obviously. But when I was playing at Gold Strike and you were over at the Horseshoe, there was a guy behind me named Jeremy, pretty big-time player, playing heads-up against another guy, and it was like 100, 200, no limit, and they were heads-up in the corner of a table playing, and it was right behind me. So that was the only time I've ever seen that in a cash game setting where these guys are playing heads-up for cash when I just walked into a room. I mean, I think I've seen it at the World Series, too, but that's different. That was like they were playing Chinese or something. But this could spark some more action. I just don't know if they'll have enough dealers to just surrender one dealer for that one little game. But I guess if they're getting enough rake out of it, because if it's playing 100 or 200, they're going to get the max rake on the hands anyway. They might. They might do that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple options. I mean, one, they could do heads-up sit-and-goes. Though, you know, I talked to another manager, and he's like, I don't think there's a market here in Florida for sit-and-goes now that the limits change. People just make more money playing cash. As well as cash games, too. I guess the other thing is it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you say no one will ever play heads-up, but you never try it, then you never know, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I think you make an excellent point. I mean, when those tournaments get down to two, why not, no matter what tournament it is, pick those people up, move them to the heads-up table, and then it becomes a spectacle in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, people are going to notice it and look at it, and then they're going to think, you know what, God, I really wish I could play heads up, and then maybe, hey, can we play heads up? And then, boom, you have it. So I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's not the most, as you mentioned, not the most efficient use of staff time. I mean, they're not going to be pushing it, I don't think, but it's there. You know, if you get two people that are waiting for a game to go play, sit down and play heads up for a little bit, that's rake. You know, that's probably worth it. If you got a dead spread dealer, might as well.
Yeah, that's true.
And one other thing I thought I think was really cool there, he has a cell phone charging station. I mean, they did this at the World Series this year. They announced it. I never actually got over to look at and see it, but so I don't think it's going to be extravagant, like, you know, I don't know, big recliners there with like a bunch of plugs and stuff. But the fact that they're thinking that you know, hey, players need to be able to charge. They're going to be here a long time. What can we do to make it more comfortable for them to be here a long time?
Yeah, it's very smart. Very smart, yeah. Because it is one of the concerns when you're sitting at the table and I look down, my phone's going to die soon. I'm not going to be there with a dead phone. I got things to do or business calls to take or whatever. And that's really smart. Very cool. And you know, they don't charge you for it too, right? You just sit there and plug in. And,
I don't think so, yeah.
Well, because you know, like the airports charge you for crap.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. The airports charge you for everything.
Yeah. But that's cool. Very smart.
Yeah, so that room's going to do a soft opening at the end of this month, which is pretty quick, and then grand opening in December. Miami Hi-Li should be close to opening its new casino poker room. And then stop to Seminole Classic. It's moving its room to a new, more dedicated area. It's not expanding it, but it's moving it, which obviously, you know, anything you do something special, it helps build some momentum. And they're going to try to resume some tournaments there. Hialeah Park is beginning to hire for this casino that's going to open probably about a year from now. And there's a new manager at Mardi Gras who's doing some real interesting promotions, including a weekly free roll that you don't have to qualify for. You just show up and play. And so, I mean, every manager I went to, and I was absolutely serious, Chris, I looked at him and I'm like, when do you guys sleep?
Yeah.
Because if I had your job, I would be scared to sleep because when I'm sleeping, somebody else in this market is doing something to beat me.
Yeah. That's just insane down there. And
big old pride. It's true.
I mean, it explains, too, why a lot of these rooms were having trouble filling the positions. Because, you know, these guys are showing up and thinking, oh, my God, I have to turn this place around and do it in this market? I mean, I'm just setting myself up for a failure. It's so difficult, you know?
Very difficult.
And that probably explains why Hialeah took so long, too. I mean, we got calls from guys 2 years ago saying, hey, I heard Hialeah's opening up next month. I'm going to interview for the job. I'm like, well, I don't think it's going to take that quick. I mean, it's going to go a lot longer. And look at it now. It's still a year away.
Yeah, a lot of that was legal entanglements, too. But, I mean, certainly there's a point here, and this is the question that comes up all the time when I'm down there, because every time I'm down there, there's more capacity added to the market. And, you know, like, is there enough poker players to go around?
Yeah, I wondered that. As soon as I saw your note on the thing about how many more things are happening, I thought the same thing. Are there really enough players down there to make everybody happy and successful? It's crazy.
Yeah, and I didn't mention that, obviously, Dania, too, is close to getting new ownership. That's supposed to totally revitalize the place and make it bigger. And then, of course, we're talking about destination casino resorts down there, which at this point I'd be shocked if they didn't even have poker rooms in this market. But, you know, at some point, I'm wondering, I mean, when are they going to run out of players?
Yeah.
I mean, so far it hasn't happened. I mean, they mentioned that when Calder came on about a year ago, Calder's going to get crushed. There's not enough people. And they struggled for a couple of months, and now they're doing quite well.
Yeah.
So they've created players or something. I don't know.
It's just insane.
Well, what's more interesting to me, too, is before I left, I saw this and I thought this was hilarious. Tony G, you know, obviously the infamous poker player, poker news guru, booked a bet on Matchbook.com, that he would cash in the World Series of Poker Europe main event. All right?
Mm-hmm.
He got 5-1 odds from the person that took the bet, wagered $20,000. And at that point, the tournament was still going on, so I was interested to see how it would work out. He would have to finish, I think 55th is where the cash started. I got home this morning and checked it, and I'm like, he actually did it. He cashed in 24th, 37,000 euros that he won. And then he gets 5-1 on that from this bet, so it's another 185,000 euros he got. He got considerably more money on this bet than he did from actually playing the tournament. And I'm quite certain the World Series of Poker Europe main event was not filled with a lot of slouches. So that was probably pretty hard to get the 24th anyhow. So, I guess there's some gee whiz fun stuff to talk about that in general. But the first thing I thought of is this the new kind of save bets here? You know, rather than taking pieces of action and a bunch of people to protect your bankroll, now if you can get somebody that doesn't believe in you as much as you do, and you can bet them and win, it's even better than playing the game, isn't it?
Well, I think it's sort of a – I think maybe it's a different thing. I don't think it's what you're thinking. I think it's more of the insurance that they used to do when they're doing coin flips. And like Helmut's always stopping the action and saying, that's what I think of it as. Because you have to have enough money to enter the event and then pay for a bet, then you don't really need people backing
you.
So it's the other way around. I think it's the insurance bet that you can't really get enough people to give you insurance anymore because there are just so many players who, one, don't come old school and don't understand it, or two, don't have enough money to do it with you. So there's only a few players who actually offer insurance now. This is your way of getting insurance on your own instead of on a hand, now on a tournament. And he got great odds because generally, a professional poker player will cash about 10 to 15% of the time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So these were good odds for him, weren't they?
Very, I mean, yeah, in general. So. And the story I saw, he mentioned that he just doubled up and blah, blah, blah. I couldn't tell by that whether he made this bet after the tournament started.
Oh, yeah.
And already had accumulated chips, which would make it even worse
right.
for his opponent, or whether it was before. But yeah, you're right. I mean, regardless, even if it was before. I would think there would be quite a few pros out there that would take 5-1 odds on them cashing.
That's pretty cool. I think I have to agree. I think a lot of pros would take that bet. And especially, you control how much you wager, too. So it's like, hey, I got a little extra this month. Maybe I'll put, you know, 10 grand on myself to whatever, you know, and then just you make 50 grand for it. You know, that's pretty decent odds. I like that idea.
Yeah, and for folks that haven't heard of Matchbook.com, it's a little different than a normal sports book where the lines makers make the wagers and accept the bets and take the vig and accept the risk on it. Matchbook is really just kind of like the eHarmony of sportsbook. You know, they're just trying to match people together. You know, hey, Tony G says I'm going to cash. Oh, yeah, well, I say you won't. Okay, well, what kind of odds you give me? By the way, all right, cool. Bring it together. Matchbook gets a little commission off of it, and everybody's happy. So it's an interesting site, an interesting way to do things. And I mean, really, from a standpoint of your bankroll management, obviously he's wagered something. We would be talking very differently right now if he didn't cash, right?
Yeah.
That he blew 20 grand on this, but or 20,000 euros, whatever it is over there. But I don't know what the buy-in for this was either. But you think about it, when you cash, I mean, you need to factor how many buy-ins you got out of that you can continue your poker career with, right?
Yeah.
And now, I mean, it's 20 more than, I don't know. I don't know what the I didn't do the math here, but I mean, think of how many tournaments you can enter now based off of just this bet.
Yeah. That's pretty crazy. I mean, I think that the person he made the wager with might have been not as poker savvy as he could have been, maybe. I mean, maybe he was. Maybe it was just somebody who thought he was on tilt or steaming or, you know, the field was pretty good. Or I don't know. But to me, it sounds like anybody who's in the poker know would be a lot closer to 9-1 or so than 5-1 if they were making that bet with somebody.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, you know, I wonder, too, though, whether other people will try to do this and what price they think is good for them. I mean, I guess the flip side of it is think about insurance. I mean, you would think in general, hey, all right, I got to give my my homeowner's insurance guy $2,000 a year. And if a tornado comes through and levels my house, I get $300,000 back. That's a great deal. You know, but I mean, they make that money up because the tornado doesn't come through that often.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they get more than 150 people as clients to pay that $2,000. So then when they get that one claim, then they can cover it. So
right,
I would imagine if somebody else out there had enough money, and you'd have to have enough money to really bankroll this properly.
Right.
You could probably make some money playing into the ego of poker players.
Well, now I'm starting to think that I have this all wrong, though. I hate doing this on the show like this, but he got 5-1 odds, which means that they were bad odds for him, because generally he wouldn't cash right one out of every five tournaments. He would cash one out of every 10 times.
All right, you're
so
right.
It's a terrible odds for him.
Good. Just think about all the headaches.
Yeah, I saved myself a bunch of headaches there. Yeah. So it's not a good idea. I wouldn't do what Tony G did. I wouldn't accept that wager. I mean, he obviously cashed and whatever, but they're saying that every one out of every 6 tournaments he would cash then, right? 5-1?
Yeah. Well, one out of every 5, yeah.
Yeah, so... Right.
Good save.
Well, all right, so no headaches. So, yeah, this is a crappy bet he took.
Good thing I wagered that you were going to save the show by correcting our mistake.
Well, in my mind, I was thinking that he was getting 20%. He would cash 20% of the time, which I guess is right, in that way, but that doesn't seem right. It's like 1 out of 5 tournaments, but you cash 1 out of 10 tournaments 10% of the time, so it's not right. It's not 20%. They're saying that, yeah, okay, so these are bad odds for him, not good.
Probably 10-1
odds. 10-1 is what I was. That's why I caught it. Because when I said 9-1, I was thinking that's the odds that he would cash, 10-1 or 9-1 or whatever. And this guy gave him 5-1, so that's terrible odds, and he still took it. All right, so good. So we saved our asses there.
And Tony G got a lot of money, so everybody's happy.
Everybody's happy except the guy who took the wager.
Yeah, but maybe he's not. That's what I said. You know, if he's got enough money to bankroll these kind of bets, and I think we would have heard about more of them. Although Tony has obviously a big mouth, so we might have heard about more of him. But I gotta think there's somebody out there. Again, we're talking ego here, right?
Yeah.
Kind of plays back to that very first thing at the top of the show. I mean, poker players have egos, and you know, some people think that they have a better shot at cashing than they really do, and that's your sweet spot if you're on the other end of it.
All right, well, if you want to call our hotline, 813-448-1120, and tell us how we almost screwed up the odds but caught it at the last minute, that's fine. We probably aren't going to use it, though. But if we do use your clip, we'll give you something really cool, like a T-shirt for PMS Pokerwear, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up Store at annieupstore.com. But we have no call this week, so we're going to move right on to our mailbag.
Yep, and remember, you can mailbag all those criticisms, complaints, laughter at our ability not to get things right to podcast@annieupmagazine.com, and we might run some of those. Or you can, of course, play us at theannieupmagazine.com/forum. All right, but our mailbag comes from a frequent contributor here, DrunkGo666.
It's from my neck of the woods.
Yep, and this is what he wrote in. He said, "Hey, guys, I've been thinking of hitting up Mohegan Sun's 1-1 game and wanted your opinion." See, we still mess things up, and people
still
continually ask for our opinion.
Are you getting 5-1 odds to play in this game?
All right. Oh, my God, you're killing me.
Sorry.
It was my brother played last week, and his advice for me was to buy in for the minimum $30 and play it like a short stack at the end of a tourney. All right, I'm already in favor of this.
Yeah, because you're the short stack ninja.
He said you can't make any mistakes this way, and you can buy in a few times with $100. Obviously, it looks like you could buy in 3 times, right?
Yeah.
for a little while. And now Drunko says he is a losing cash game player, mind you, and he lost 150 in this session playing this way. I would hate to take playing small pairs and suited connectors in position out of my arsenal against what is sure to be a game with loose bad players. I prefer to have 100 big blinds when I play cash because I like to play more hands and look to stack someone, not just win small pots. What do you think?
I think that he should trust his own feelings and not listen to his brother. I think more than small pairs and suited connectors are taken out of your arsenal by buying in short. You lose a lot Absolutely. More than that. I think that buying in for $30 is just going to make you lose $30. That's all it's going to do, and more people are going to call you. And when I see this at the table, it's almost always associated with someone who's drunk. And so since it's Drunko666, I'm thinking that he may be wanting to get drunk and play this way. I wouldn't advocate that either. And I think we just mentioned this last week, but I remember playing at a game similar to this at Tampa Bay Downs where they were buying in for 20 and 25 at a time, and I was just taking all of their money because they were just going in on draws all the time. If you have a solid pair, you call their draws, and even if you lost $30, it's no big deal to you because you got a decent stack. But to them, who's buying in for sure, it's do or die every single time. And even when you double up, you still only have $60, and you're still not going to stack anybody, and you're still not going to be able to play the way you need to play to succeed in that game. And look what happened to your brother. How can he tell you that's what you should do and then tell you you lost 150 in the session?
Well, yeah, as a small statistical sample there. But yeah, I know what you mean. You know, I guess I'm not as harsh necessarily on this, on the idea. I mean, I think there are advantages to buying in at the minimum, different advantages, and not as many maybe as playing traditional, which is to have the 100 big blinds. But I think what's wrong is when he says you can't make any mistakes this way.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
You have to accept the fact that when you buy in for the minimum that you are already making some mistakes, and you've decided in your mind that you can overcome those mistakes. I mean, that mistake is not having enough money to push people off hands. As he said, play some of these other hands the way you want to. Essentially, what you're saying is, I can't be pushed off a hand, I think is what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
So I can't make the mistake of folding the better hand to someone. If I only got $30 in front of me and he raises me, you know what? It's shipping. It's going in. And I'm not going to make that mistake. I get, but I think you got blinders on that you're not making other mistakes as part of that.
I completely agree. And like you said, there are benefits to buying in short, like you just said, but when I play poker, I try to weigh all of the benefits on both sides of every equation and then pick the one that gives me more benefits. And clearly, buying in with 100 big blinds gives you more benefits than buying in short. And so that's why I would always
go there. Boy. You're channeling Gundam with it, clearly.
Well, we can obvious. Add them up. We can add them up if you want.
But 100 big blinds, it's obvious.
The show is going to be long enough already. We're already 40 minutes in, and we're rolling on mailbag. So I'm not going to weigh them all, but I would think that we've talked about all the negatives of $30 buy-ins versus $100 buy-in.
All right, I'm not going to extend this too long because you're right, we need to move on. But a lot of it is assessing the table and the situation. If I'm in a game with crazy, super unimaginable action, people raising 50 preflop with junk and 9 people calling, some people might want to sit down with 1,000 chips and play that game. I would not. I would not do well with $1,000 in front of me in that game. In that game, I would sit down with a minimum and take shots and try to build up some money. That's me. That's not saying anybody else be that way. But a lot of that thinks on the game. If you sit down at a table with 10 rocks of Gibraltar in front of you, that fold to every single bet, then no, why would you ever want to buy in for that game for the minimum? You buy in for more, the maximum, and just put pressure on them all day. It's just a different, you know, it all depends on your players, but I don't think in general you can make a statement. But yeah, more often than not, much more often than not, you're better off not buying in light.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the opposite of what that you said. I would rather play with a full stack against guys who are crazy and be able to take advantage of that when I do have a hand and whatever, then not. But like you said, it's, and if you're playing your way, then you're just playing scared. So I wouldn't want to. There's a reason why you wouldn't buy in is because you think that you can't win that way.
Everybody else is playing crazy, so I'm trying to play against type.
Yeah, no, but you can still play tight.
I'll wait till I get a good hand, and then I can stack them. And that's to me, that's a bad way of playing, too, because how often do you get a good hand? I mean, all poker is being able to play situations.
Well, I don't want to lose, you know, a huge chunk of my stack or my whole stack at a short buy every time I think I have the advantage and I don't, and then I lose these guys rather than just being patient. That's why you have a big stack, so that you can be patient.
In a gambling game, it's a gambling. There's much less skill when people gamble more than when they play more conservatively.
Well,
so $30, I mean, if I'm going to gamble, I'd rather gamble with $30 than I would with $1,000. But again, that's just me.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That's you, and that's not me. And again, to me, if I'm going to sit down and be afraid to lose how much I'm sitting down for, then I shouldn't be sitting down anyway. So I don't want to sit down with $30. I can't play poker then.
But you're not playing poker in that game anyhow. I guess
I know. But that's why I'm sitting down with more than $30. You know, you're saying if you're not playing poker, you're gambling.
We're talking in circles. It's hilarious.
I know.
All right, moving on. Call for this week. I'm sorry. Just a reminder, folks, if you email a mailbag to us and we use it and we haven't already sent you swag, we'll send you something wonderful like a download with the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net. And now moving on to Call the Floor. Dave Morenweg, one of our longtime listeners, I believe from, I want to say New York, but maybe I'm getting my Daves confused.
We have so many Daves.
But anyhow, he writes in and says, in a charity event, seat 3 leads out after the flop. Seat 4 moves in. Action gets back to seat 3, who goes in the tank. It would be awesome if he actually had a real tank.
You could sit in, yeah.
Yeah. All right, time dealer. All right, sure. Got to get in the tank.
Go in the think tank.
Seat 3 asks for a count on seat 4 stack. The dealer counts out the chips. Seat 3 then counts out an equal number of chips and moves them forward, although these tables have no lines on them, so there's never a line to cross. Seat 3 then says that she never said call and hasn't yet made her decision. Seat 3 finally makes the call and wins the hand. So Dave wants to know, is the cutting and chip moving forward action of seat 3 sufficient to be a call?
Okay, well, here, Jody Russell, our poker room manager for our Andy Poker Cruises, chimes in and says, this is going to be a judgment call based on what the dealer sees and how they relay it to the floor person. In this situation, some rooms have a hard and fast rule that any movement of chips toward the pot is an aggressive act that stands. In other rooms, this isn't the case. This player could have been simply trying to separate the chips from the rest of the stack to see what would be left. A floor person making a call in this situation has to determine whether the player was taking a shot at the other player or honestly trying to evaluate the situation by moving the call amount away from the rest of the stack. One of the important considerations for me, and that's Jody, not me, would be how far they were moved. If they are only an inch or two away, that doesn't mean much to me. But if they are several inches away or halfway between the pot and the original stack, I would rule that a call. Situations like this are a big reason why I always insist on personally watching the action very closely once we get a tournament to the payouts. This way I see it as it occurs and can make more accurate rulings when it can mean more or less money to the players involved. It's a great point. And you know, one thing I wanted to say was when I first started playing poker, I started playing tournaments, and I've told this story numerous times, but I went to Derby Lane and I didn't really know the etiquette of where you put your cards and stuff, and I had my cards behind my chips, and like the big guy was like, hey, who's dealing? He's like, are you all in? And I'm like, no, why? He said, well, because your chips are in front of your cards. That's a rule here that you're all in, so you better move your cards to the front. And I was like, whoa. And so it was clear that I wasn't all in, but he was trying to make a point that you got to be careful here. And it was true. Derby Lane has a lot of strict rules, but right. They're all very good rules. And if you started playing at Derby Lane, you wouldn't have these problems anywhere else because they have...
Good point.
Yeah. They teach you, really, this is what you need to do because you want to be clear. You want to be verbal with your bets and blah, 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 and say everything you mean. And so I totally agree with the chips moving forward thing. You moved your chips forward, and it's any kind of a move toward the pot, you know, it's a bet. I mean, there's a way of, you know... You circling your chips out of the stack back to your thing or something where it's clear that you're not pushing them. But when somebody starts to push forward, that's a bet. And I remember that huge World Series ruling a year or two ago, and it was just crazy. The guy was like, you know, pushing him in and then not or something. It was crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I totally agree with Jody, judgment. I think that we need to be careful with how we're moving our chips and how far away they are from our other chips. And I think that if she was just cutting them out and counting, and a lot of people try to say it ahead of time. You know, you're a big proponent of saying that when we teach these one-on-one courses too, is say what you want to do. So if you tell the dealer, I'm not calling here, I'm just pulling my chips out to see how many, and then you're covered too. So
yeah, at least more covered.
I mean, at least more covered.
I care, but at least you're letting the people know, hey, I'm not, you know, when I make my decision, I'll tell you what it is. I'm not, I mean, I guess people can still think you're angle shooting at that point, but at least you're saying, you know, hey, I'm just seeing how much it's going
right.
to, how much of this stack it's going to cost me, blah, blah, blah. It could only help, I would think.
But that was a great letter, because that does come up a lot. People moving their chips around, and, you know, it's just stuff that you're, and plus when, you know, we're always, as we will in this show, we're always advocating traveling and playing at different places. And it's just, it's good stuff to know and good stuff to practice, because, you know, you're going to find these things. Like when we went to California and I'm like, why are they taking the money out of the pot already? I don't understand what's going on. And you just have to learn. You have to ask questions. So, you know, keep it, you know, try to be as overt and intentional as possible with what you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, we got an amazing news desk this week, Chris.
Yes.
I'm going to skip right to it because it's so amazing.
And actually, more news
came in that we're just going to have to wait till next week. first, as we mentioned at the top of the show, NBC has canceled the National Heads Up Championship, the latest casualty in the poker TV marketplace in the wake of Black Friday.
Yeah, this isn't a very big surprise. I was actually more surprised that they had it this year than I am that it's canceled now. So,
well, that actually happened in March. Before Black Friday. So.
No, but I'm talking about televising it. I mean,
televising, so, right, you know, yeah, sure.
To find enough sponsors to pay for it after or something. You know, they could still say, hey, the heads up champion is this guy. But
well, my understanding, and this is just kind of a conjecture on the part of, I believe, either Wicked Chops or Poker News, which both reported this, is that, you know, it could be tough to get pros to pay $20,000 out of their own pocket to play in this thing.
Yeah.
Without having Full Tilt or Poker Stars or UB or any of those places pay for their entries in there, because, you know, those sites obviously know in this tournament you're going to be on TV. You know, it's not like a 1,000-player tournament where you have to make the final table or be on the feature tables.
Right.
I mean, you're on the heads up. You're going to get some TV time, even if you're quickly dispatched, and you're probably going to get a lot of TV time. So, I mean, they're more likely to probably pay your way in, and now obviously that's not going to happen. So I think it was probably a stretch to think that they could get the caliber of player that they did.
Yeah.
Again, I mean, the actual TV sponsors are another issue, I think. But I think it's unfortunate. I didn't actually watch it this year, but I always liked the format. I like heads-up play. And, you know, obviously they're a little crazy trying to invite a lot of celebrities in that didn't make much sense. But I give them credit for doing something different, and it's unfortunate it's not there, and I'm hoping something fills the void, but it's going to be tough, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely it was definitely something that was unique to the poker television market, because you don't really see heads-up play anywhere else. And occasionally you'll see a European one on one of those remote channels or something when they have their heads-up stuff. But it's sad. It's sad to see it go. It was something that promoted the game at national level and was a different way to promote the game, and you got to see a lot of personalities. So, yeah, it's sad that it's gone. I have a feeling it'll be back, though. You know, once this other stuff gets hammered out. So, all right, many skins on the Merge Gaming Network have resumed accepting most U.S. players after a month-long hiatus when it was restructuring its payment processing and moving its servers. So that's I don't know what to think about that, actually. That's good news, I guess, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you just are hardcore and want to play online, it's good news, because, I mean, probably if you're hardcore, you probably already had a Merge account and you were unaffected by this because you were already in before they quit taking people in May, I think it was,
right.
and you were still playing. But now, obviously, it opens it up for more people to come on, which, obviously, player liquidity is always good for you. But there's just not a lot of places left to play online, and I know a lot of people still are a little apprehensive about playing on Merge.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't know. Now they got this all taken care of, but, I mean, is there another indictment hanging? I don't know.
Good points.
But, yeah, if you're already on there, I mean, there's probably definitely going to be more people playing soon, so that's not a bad thing.
All right.
All right, finally, Nevada gaming regulators have approved the acceptance of 5 prop bets in the upcoming November 9, including who the first player to bust will be, whether the chip leader will win, what the winning hand will be, how many hands will be dealt at the final table, and whether more red or black cards will appear on the first flop.
I love that last one.
Well, it's classic poker props there.
Yeah, absolutely. Reminds me of when Ivy and that Sahamias guy were flipping 50 grand for flops. That's just crazy.
All right, I'm going to take a shot here. I haven't researched, so I don't know who the first player to bust will be. But I'm going to say the chip leader will not win.
Okay.
I'm going to say the winning hand will be two pair. How many hands will be dealt at the final table? Wow. 150. And I'm Wesley Snipes. I always bet on black.
I knew you were going to say that.
Black cards.
I almost said it for you. I would definitely say that the chip leader will not win. The winning hand will be ace high.
Ace high.
I'm going to say the final table will have 275 hands dealt.
Wow. Okay.
And I'll go with red just so one of us is right.
What if there's an equal number on the flop? What if there's a half red, half black card?
The other thing, too, is I won't guess on the first player to bust because I don't want to jinx anybody. But
that's true.
But then again, I'm saying the chip leader won't win, so that's not fair either. But I'm not going to guess.
Oh, you're just saying
first.
The chip leader could bust. Yeah. I mean, well, you're not jinxing him. I mean, he's got enough chips. I mean, he's allowed to be jinxed.
Yeah, he can live against a mojo. I
mean,
I guess you
would probably say the short stack would be the first one to be bust.
Yeah. All right, it's time for O'Malley's move.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. We're sitting back at the old $1, $2 No Limit Hold'em Casino Cash Game. It's a busy night, and they've squeezed an 11th player on the table. The table has been fairly predictable, betting their good hands, and check folding when they don't have at least top pair. We bought in for $200, and have only lost the small and big blind. We've only been playing for around a half an hour, and haven't gotten much yet. Additionally, we're not sure how solid our read is on the table, since we've only been here a limited amount of time, but we were fortunate enough to observe the same table for about 20 minutes or so while waiting for a seat. The blinds post, under the gun calls, under the gun plus one folds, under the gun plus two folds, and we're sitting on the under the gun plus three position with queen of spades, queen of hearts. We are not going to fool around here, especially with an extra player on the table. The standard raise seems to be 15, but we're going to make it $20 straight. We want to push out any stragglers that might want to come along with hands we don't want to be up against. Under the gun plus four folds, hijack folds. Cutoff raises our bet to $60. The problem with him is he just barely sat down and has us covered easily. The button folds, the small blind folds, and the big blind pushes all his chips into the center of the table, 375. Well, it's back to us. Are we good here?
All right, part two of our road trip. You know, this we're stretching this road trip out on the show longer than we actually were on the road.
That's true.
I find some humor in that.
That's true.
All right, so this week we're going to be talking about Southern California. Last week, of course, we talked about Los Angeles. Coming weeks, we'll talk about Northern California, St. Louis. And just as a reminder, we didn't visit every room in the area on this crazy trip that we took last month. Only the largest. So there's a lot more rooms in these areas that we're mentioning. Visit our Where to Play page on AnyUpMagazine.com for a complete list and map. If you're making it out there. And just a quick aside, you know, we got emails from someone saying, you know, hey, I was hoping for real detailed information on all these rooms, what kind of games they got. And I know you responded to them, but what I would say is it's really impossible for us on a trip like this to ascertain that kind of information. I mean, we can ask the manager. We always do, actually. You know, what kind of games do you normally get? But to be able to say with certainty that there's going to be an 8-16 Omaha game going, when you show up, I think it's really difficult to say that.
No, it's impossible. I mean, you could say it, but it wouldn't be true.
I mean, you could say they never get stud. I mean, that's something that you could
Yeah, if they told us.
But, I mean, to give an idea of what games the limits are going to be going most of the time, that's a little more difficult. Though I will say, on this trip to South Florida, I forgot to mention this, but there are a couple new apps that are out on the marketplace now that I think are going to get some love out there. One actually is from the Genesis Bravo folks.
Oh, yeah.
And it taps into the Genesis Bravo system at participating rooms, and it's an app where you can actually get in and see the number of games being dealt at that moment and the limits.
That's huge.
And they think eventually they'll be able to add wait lists in there, too, so you can see how many people are waiting on it. I mean, that's a pretty cool app, I think.
That's huge.
And that kind of answers this question better than we can in a show now that's going to be archived, and 3 years from now you're going to go out there and go, hey, you said there was stud high low there. There was stud high low.
The other thing, too, that's good about that is a lot of these places mention that they have the phone-in thing
where
you can call in. The minute you call in is where they'll put you on the list. And then you can, if you had that app, you could gauge, okay, there's 10 guys on the list. If I call right now, I can get there in an hour and probably get on, whatever. So it's pretty cool. It's very beneficial.
Absolutely. All right, well, I'll get started with an overview of Southern California. Remember, this is everywhere but L.A.
Right.
In Southern California. And also, when you talk about Southern California, for the most part, you're thinking of the Los Angeles room. Those are the ones that get the attention. I mean, some of these other ones we're going to talk about, obviously, people have heard of, so it's not all like that. But I think it's fair to say that when you think of even California poker, for that matter, the entire state, you're thinking Commerce, Bike, those kind of places, right?
Right, right.
And I was really, really honestly amazingly impressed with the rooms that we're going to be talking about today. And again, these are different. I mean, all these ones, I believe, I'm looking through our notes, all these ones that we're going to talk about today are actual tribal casinos.
Mm-hmm.
And we mentioned that last week in California, you've got tribal casinos that look more like casino resorts and games and slot machines, and then you've got the card clubs, which are like the Commerce and the Bike. So I think that plays into it a little bit. I mean, obviously, when you have that kind of money, you can build really nice facilities. But I thought these were great rooms and great places. And to be honest, I really enjoyed the drive.
Yeah. Yeah, I did too.
Very beautiful country out of there.
That was when we were seeing all those windmills and, the mash-like mountains.
Mash-like mountains.
And it was just a nice drive. And even when the locales of these places, which we've mentioned before, but a lot of them were like in mountains.
Yeah.
And so you had to drive up the mountains to get to them. And that was kind of a pain. But the payoff was worth it when you got there. The scenery, just the way these, a lot of them are like carved right into the mountain almost. They're just so beautiful. So yeah, I enjoyed the aesthetics of it too as well.
Yeah, to me, I'm a player that I just need to feel relaxed when I'm playing. Again, I play for fun, all right? I'm not trying to be a pro here. When I go out and play poker, I'm number one on my list is having fun. And I can't have fun when I'm not comfortable. So, obviously, there are things within the room that make you comfortable. But I think just the drive out there put me in a good frame of mind. It was just relaxing and knowing I could get up from the table, walk outside, and see mountains and fresh air and stuff and not sprawl and smog and stuff.
Yeah.
Or anything like that, I think just put me in a better mindset.
Yeah, it was definitely a beautiful drive and beautiful surroundings. I was very happy with it. I mean, it wasn't wasn't Hollywood glamour, but it was definitely a beautiful setting. And I guess we'll start with San Manuel, which again, beautiful. The mountains like come right down to it. Very large room. And when we were there, the place was hopping. And
it was a Wednesday morning.
It was a Wednesday morning. We're like, oh my God, how's this place hopping on a Wednesday morning? Well, they did have a free roll going on, but that didn't matter. I mean, yeah, there were quite a few people that were playing in the free roll, but there were a lot of cash games. And that was something that I was really impressed with. Throughout California, there was always action.
Yeah.
We've gone on a lot of road trips where you go in, there's one table going on. No matter what time of day it is, night, whatever, there's some of these rooms are just dead.
Yeah.
And this road trip, every room was not packed, but had a ton of action.
Had action going on. You're right.
It was great.
And none of them shocked me more than this one. And maybe it was just, the morning, you just got up on the first day, but I walked in. I mean, I'm just not expecting to see that much action on a Wednesday morning anywhere.
Yep.
Even Commerce or any place like that. I mean, it was going. Of course, the free roll was part of it, but it really was only part of it. I mean, the guy was like, hey, the free roll's over there. And I'm like, okay, that's great. And then you turn around and there's still 20, 30 tables going.
Yep.
All cash. So, very nice place.
And they had the cool chip runners, too, with the aprons and the cash.
Yeah, yeah.
That was just so cool. And the guy we talked to was Lindley.
Lindley, yes.
He's
right.
Australian, and it was a cool guy, and he helped us out a lot. And, you know, it would have been nice to talk to the actual poker room manager there, but it just goes to show you the staff was still very accommodating. The guy sat down with us for like a half an hour, 20 minutes to talk to us and answered all of our questions. So it was a real helpful staff, and just enjoyed it. I liked the way the room looked, too, the wood and everything. It was a nice place to play, it looked like.
Absolutely. Then we moved on to Morongo, which, of course, I've heard of before. It's been on TV a little bit. I know when we were driving up, you're like, hey, those are the windmills.
Yeah.
I've seen it on TV. you know, because we don't get those here in Florida. Not much here in Florida. I'm trying to think. I mean, we probably have them somewhere.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen them.
But not as prevalent as they were there. And, of course, it spawned this four-hour discussion. Gundam Scott kind of discussion with you and me about windmills, which is kind of funny. But this was the first room that we saw the five-card Omaha.
Yes. Yes.
We'll talk about that a little later in Pechanga because we got to play it there. But, yeah, the guy was like, oh, yeah, over there, that's the five-card Omaha, you know, just as a throwaway because they've been playing there for years, he said.
Yeah.
And I had never heard of it.
I just, you know, it was great. I mean, and then we actually wrote a little piece about it for the magazine, this upcoming issue, because, you know, I've never heard of it. And just because it's there doesn't mean the whole world knows about it. So it's something to look forward to if you go down to Southern California. It's at Morongo, and like you said, it's at Pechanga, And the guy says get some big pots going there, big action, so very cool.
Yeah, this is a nice room, and what I like about these, personally, I like rooms that are separated from casino but close to it, because you want the kind of that walk-in traffic, but at the same time, I don't want to hear a bunch of bells and whistles and stuff, that's not me.
Right.
I certainly don't want any smoke coming in, so it's separated from the casino, and we get to chat with the manager, Dwayne Sandoval, just a little bit. He was actually doing an employee tournament that day.
And it's a cool employee tournament, too.
Yeah.
Very cool. They give away prizes to everybody who gets knocked out, and then if you knock out the management, you get like a really big bounty and stuff. And they do it like once every 6 months, and just real player employee friendly. I mean, and it was really kind of cool. And he was having a lot of fun. We didn't want to bother him, so we talked to another floor person there, and same kind of thing. Very friendly. Talked to us about what we wanted to know, and they had a thirst station right in the room too.
Yeah,
your favorite
thing. You know how important thirst stations are to me. So and it was right there. I didn't even have to walk. I mean, I'd be a fat guy there. I mean, as much as I would drink the diet, those 1 calories would add up when I don't have to walk out of the casino to the third station. So,
well, anybody who follows our tweets too would know that that's why Scott's always visiting the restroom, because he's like this cycle of, you know, all right, there's the third station, get a drink. Oh, I got to use the restroom. Oh, there's the third station, get a drink. Oh, I got to use the restroom. It's just like our trips would be so much shorter if Scott didn't recognize third stations when we walked in. It's brutal.
But the highlight of this stuff, really, I mean, I shouldn't say that. I mean, the room is gorgeous, so it highlights wrong. But the unexpected part of this stop is probably a better way of saying it. We went to this nearby restaurant, Ruby's Casino. I think it's actually owned by the Morongos. I know it's on the receipt that I got. But it's this old 50s-style diner, and we had the best waiter in the history of waitering.
Absolutely.
Am I overstating that?
I thought the guy owned the place, just by the way he was. It was incredible. I mean, he was like the most professional, courteous, thoughtful waiter we have ever had, ever on any road trip, or of any trip. I mean, he was incredible.
Any restaurant.
Yeah, it was remarkable. It was almost to the point of like, are we on TV?
Yeah, yeah.
He was so good, real attentive, knew everything you would possibly need or want, and made sure you had plenty of it, and it was really cool, real enjoy, and you know. And the other thing too is that what I loved about California, and I don't know if I talked about this or not, but it's like a law out there or something where you got to have the calories next to items that you're buying. So you know me and my caloric diet that I have going. So that was really nice to know. Okay, I'm not going to buy this double cheeseburger because it's got 1,500 calories in it. That's my whole allotment. So that was really cool. Even when we went to like a Chipotle restaurant in Northern California, they told me how many calories were in a burrito, and that was just sick to me, because I know there's no way for me to figure it out in my own head. So But yeah, we had a great time at this Ruby's place, and best waiter ever.
Such a great waiter that we forget his name. I can't even tell you it.
I think it was Bob.
Bob? Yeah, okay. That's a good guess. Thanks, Bob.
It's Bob or Ben or something. I don't know.
All right, well, we made a little, you know, it's tough charting out these trips. You know,
you did a hell of a job, though.
Thank you, sir. You know, because you got to go from here to here, and you're trying to, you don't know how the roads are going, and Google Maps is great, but not perfect. And I originally kind of cut out Agua Caliente on our trip, and then when we were out there, we realized it was probably a little closer than I thought. Yeah, we had some time, so we drove out to Palm Springs, and I'm glad we did.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It was really a good stop, and one, it's nice to get out to Palm Springs. You always hear about it. And it's really not all that far from Morongo. But again, another property with a gorgeous property and great room. And I think they're excited. They just started some new $75 tournaments with $25 bounties on them. It was a good place to play for in Palm Springs.
Yep, sure. And now, is that one of the tribal ones too?
Yeah. I think all these
okay.
are tribal.
Yeah. I wasn't sure. Okay, yeah. So yeah, that was pretty cool, and it was nice. It's a big room. It had Ante Up magazine there, so we were happy about that.
Yeah. Any room that likes us, we like them.
Yep, and they were right next to a movie or a theater or whatever it was, the concert place or something. It was right next to it.
Yeah.
I didn't know if that was an issue or not, but it was. You had to walk past all that to get in, and it was nice. And the room was closed off too, so you didn't have to. You wouldn't hear the noise either. It was kind of walled off in its own place. So very nice place.
And then of course we moved on to Pechanga.
Yep.
See, I used to say Pechanga, right?
I say, but it's Pechanga.
I know. So I'm working
but
on
you say
Pechanga.
You're getting better. You're getting better at it.
In Temecula. of course, we stayed the night at that very functional Best Western where we take the show. Everybody remembers the air conditioning unit from that. But after we take the show, we drove over to Pechanga. And really a gorgeous property. The poker room is massive in terms of square footage.
Right.
But they didn't cram it full of tables, which I like. You know,
no, there was definitely
airy.
A lot of room.
In fact, actually, they probably could put 10 more tables in there, and I would still call it airy.
Yeah.
But like a two-level, wasn't it? I mean, that's a table down, and then they had like a middle area that's slightly raised, and then they had this massive, huge scoreboard, like TV, right above you. Near the raised area, which is kind of cool when you're on the outside watching it, like I was. I mean, we were there the night of the last night of the regular season of the baseball.
Yeah,
and it was just an amazing place to sit there and watch it because there's 4,000 TVs everywhere, and you have these big scoreboards. So all night there, I was sitting there watching Longoria hit his home run over and over and over on 180 inches above it. But definitely a place for sports fans to go, I would say.
Well, the problem for me was that I was sitting under it. And so when you're under this huge scoreboard-type thing, it's constantly blinking for the – like when it changes whatever stations or when it changes views or whatever. So when you're sitting looking at your old cards or you're playing – you just it's like you're in one of the – you're getting interrogated by some, you know, poorly screwed-in fluorescent light bulb, and it's blinking. You know, it's just driving me crazy when I was playing under it. But – outside of it, it'd be kind of cool. You know, it was definitely this huge stadium kind of feeling, you know, or whatever, hockey rink feeling. But, yeah, it was kind of tough with the light blinking over my head every... And it wasn't that it was blinking. It was the TV screen was just changing shots. And so it'd go from light to dark, and I'm like... It's like almost a strobe light sometimes. So it was kind of driving me crazy. But yeah, this is where we played Five Card Omaha.
Yeah.
And, you played. I sort of fumbled.
I donated.
It was terrible. For me, I just kept making the second nuts. Or actually, I would make the nuts and then have it change the whole way. And it would always happen in a kill pot. And Scott gives me the most sage advice on the planet. Chris, you don't want to lose the kill pots. Gee, thanks, Scott. You think?
Hey, I've been around the rodeo a couple times. I know how it works.
I went through a $100 buy-in faster than, you know, a fat guy on a cupcake. So... It was brutal, but you won, and I was glad you won. At least one of us won that night.
Yeah, and it's a real fun game. I hesitated. I didn't want to introduce it to the home game the last time because we had some folks that don't normally play. But I'm definitely bringing it into the home game because I think it's great for a home game, to be honest, because it's an action game. It increases the action, obviously, the more cards you have in your hand. I should say five-card Omaha plays the same way as regular Omaha 8's high low, and you know you must use two in your hand and three on the board. You just have an extra card to choose from,
right?
And I really think for home game players, I mean, it's a way to increase some action because you know split pot games sometimes in home game when you're playing like six handed or something, you know, you're splitting the pots, and it just doesn't seem like it's worth the effort, right?
No.
So
yeah.
if you can get the action going, certainly by adding that extra card in. Everybody's got a much better hand to start with, and you're probably going to get more action. So I definitely think it's a good game for home games. In a casino, I mean, I would love to play it. I don't think casinos need to adopt it at all, but I really enjoyed playing it that night. It was fun.
I got away from the cardinal rule of poker in that the more cards you were dealt, the tighter you should be.
Yes.
And I continued to be loose, and even more loose than I normally play four-card Omaha, for just for some reason. I just felt like the players weren't that good around me, but it didn't matter because I was the worst. You know, and they say you look around the table and you don't see the Rube. It's probably you. It was definitely me in that game. I just felt it was so nice to play a game that wasn't No Limit Hold'em that I didn't care. I really wanted to play it, and yeah, I should have just tightened up a lot more than I did, and I didn't. So I paid the price. So I went over to No Limit Hold'em and played under the strobe light, and I had this real interesting hand. And so just real quick, I had been getting crap hands for a long time and was making a lot of moves to try to stay afloat, and some were working, some weren't. But finally, I'm in the big blind, and I get pocket aces, two black aces, and I'm like, all right. Well, remember what we talked about last week on the show? People like to chop a lot here, and it tends to like go all the way around to the big blind, small blind, and fold, and then chop. So I flick up with aces, and I know there's like there are high hands here. So I'm right. Like, all right, I got pocket aces, I can make a high hand. Maybe I should, you know, play this hand out. And so folds around to the small blind, and the guy's got a huge stack, and I'm like, oh my god, I have to chop now. So he looks at me and he goes, chop. And I'm like, are we an automatic chop, or are you saying you want to play this out? And he's like, well, I have the best hand, so I would advise you to chop. And I'm like, no, I have the best hand, I would advise you to chop. And he says, no, I have the best. And this goes on for like 45 minutes. And finally, the table, everyone's laughing. Finally, the guy just shows me two red aces and says, you have a better hand than this? And I said, since the ace of spades is the highest card in the deck, yes, I do. And I show him that two black aces. And the table just started roaring. And I mean,
avoided any chance of winning in any bad beats by talking about your hand. But.
Which obviously we can't because we're not qualified for any bad beat anyway. So it's impossible to have a bad beat. It was impossible for either one of us to win or lose other than a flush. And that wouldn't have been a high hand or a bad beat. So we just ended up taking back my $3 or whatever it was. But it was so brutal. I waited like an hour for that hand. I finally get it, and the guy next to me in the blinds, and it folds around, has the aces. I mean, how often does two aces and two aces come up against each other, but then do it when they're both in the blinds, and it folds around on that hand? No one raises at this really loose table that one time. I was like, I know I'm jinxed to lose on this trip. I mean, once that happened, I knew I was never going to win another dollar as long as I lived. It was brutal.
Absolutely hilarious.
But we had a good time in Pechanga, had a real nice talk with them, and enjoyed the property. I had a nice chicken Caesar salad, and we moved on. So the other place I really liked was Pala.
Yeah, we started the next morning with Pala. I had a great chat there with both the manager and the PR manager. And I'll say this about Jack Taylor, the PR manager there. What a great guy.
Yeah.
I mean, not that any of these other people we haven't met on the trip weren't great, but you know, we do a lot of these trips, and sometimes the PR folks insist on sitting in to be sure the poker manager doesn't say anything bad because the mean bad press is there.
Right.
And generally, they aren't bad people. It's just it's kind of weird that they need to be handled. This is very different. I mean, he's a very different kind of PR guy, and he also oddly does his job well.
Yes.
Sends us lots of press releases. Yes. I mean, that's your job as a PR, right? It's amazing to me how many of these rooms don't send us a lot of information. And but great guy, he and George, the manager. We had a fun time talking to him.
And that whole small world thing, too. George, the manager there, is the brother of one of the guys that was a manager down here that we made friends with, Pete. And it was like, oh, my God. And we found out that he commutes across the country.
Yeah. He lives in Atlantic City.
He lives like in Atlantic City or a Philly area or whatever, and he goes all the way across the country every like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
That's just killer. I couldn't even commute to like the next county. And this guy goes all the way across the country every 3 weeks. And Jack goes like to Vegas or Nevada or whatever. Yeah. I mean that's just insane to me, but they love their job so much. That says a lot about Pala as a company, you know, or whatever. And they had some cool promotions. One of the ones that was really cool was the one where there's enough money for it, but when the money's gone, the promotion's over, and it's the amount of hours that you clock determines how much money you get or something. It was really kind of cool.
Yeah, I forget all the particulars, but I'm sure if you go to the Palace website, you can read about it or if you live near there. But essentially, it's really rewarding locals or, I guess, tourists who happen to be there at the beginning of the month for a lot of play. I mean, you clock in, and you know, some of these places, you know, you play 5 hours a night or 20 hours a week or something, you'll get a ticket or something. Here, it did, but there was a finite amount of money. So it turned it into a race where, you know, the first one to 100 hours gets X, and that money's paid out, and then there's less money to be paid out after that. So it was a very interesting promotion in a sense of getting people in early and playing. And then I didn't actually see what happens at the end, what they do to keep you there. I mean, that's always one of these fallacies of these, or problems in these promotions, is what happens when the money's gone.
Yeah, we get you in, and then when the money's gone, they get up and leave. You know, when the bad beat hits, the big record bad beats, everybody splits. So I don't know if it's that important, because a lot of the people are playing, and it's a bonus to get a couple hundred.
Well, a lot of hours, too, so it probably doesn't matter. But a nice little twist on the normal hourly promotion kind of thing.
Speaking of cool promotions, Harrah's Rincon, man.
Yep.
You know, they're a Harrah's property, obviously, so they already have the whole, you know, rewards card thing going, which is pretty significant, because you can transfer them to any Harrah's, and they're pretty generous with it once you do that. And so, but now they've got this thing, pay for play,
right?
Which, you know, they'll give you money on top of the rewards too. And he was saying something to the effect that A-Rate's player is the same as a $10 per hand blackjack player.
Yeah,
right. That's huge, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's huge, but it's huge in the poker world.
I mean, yeah, of course.
Generally, you're going to be playing $10 a hand to get even noticed at a blackjack table now. So it's probably the minimum of the rating. But still, I mean, if you think about the amount of money a $10 a hand blackjack player makes the casino versus your everyday poker player, it's not even close. So, that was the first time I ever heard anybody say to that level. I mean, usually when we're talking to people, it's, you know, $1 an hour, $2 an hour, 50 cents an hour, something like that.
Yeah.
And honestly, I guess we didn't really ask what that rate turns out to be, but I think it's got to be fairly significant. And then you're like, you said it's on the total rewards card, and which is I don't think anybody can dispute that's not the most valuable poker rewards card out there now, just based on the properties, number of properties that contribute to it.
Yeah.
And then this pay for play on top of it. A lot of reasons to be playing there. And it's interesting because the room is up on the second floor. I mean, because we actually talked to the director of casino ops before we actually got to go see the room. So he was trying to tell us about it. And you have some people like it, some people don't, because it's closer to the hotel. They can get up to the room afterwards. But it really is on the second floor. It's up like down a hallway.
Yeah.
You have to know where you're going to find it. And it's real nice and intimate when you get in there, but you got to get there.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's weird. It's like I'm not really a big fan of having to go a long way to get to my poker room, but I am a big fan of isolated poker rooms that are quiet. So it's like I have to make a decision, which is more important to me. And
right.
But being quiet is more important to me. So I welcome the walk there, and you know, I'll burn off the nachos that I ate anyway. So, but no, really, I liked the idea. And it was kind of a smallish room. It wasn't really big. But they also host a circuit event, so they use their, you know, their convention facilities or whatever it is they use for it. But they have the only circuit stop right now in California. I guess the bike is getting one soon or whatever, but as of now, the current one, they have the circuit event. And that's the one where I think Chris Ferguson beat Prahlad Friedman that time when he had quads versus a full house and won the ring. So that was a few years ago. But nice place, nice guy. Had a lot of fun with them, and you know, the funny thing is that we go there and we're like, all right, you know, when you go to Harrah's, you always got to like check in with security.
Right.
These other ones, you can just walk in and talk to whoever you want to talk to, basically. But these guys, they want to make sure you check in. And then when it's a tribal place on top of it, it's really strict. So we go back there and we find the security guard, and we're like, hey, you know, we're here to meet with this person, and can you get him for us? And so the guy says, yeah, all right, hang on. He calls over, and the guy's like, all right, he'll be down to come. He's going to send somebody to come get you. I said, okay. So I thought to myself, you know, I'm not a very social person. In fact, Scott's always a social one. For some reason on these trips, every once in a while, I'll talk to somebody, and, you know, and just to pass the time. And I thought, well, this guy's wearing a little Dallas Cowboys logo on his shirt. So maybe I'll, you know, just strike up a football conversation with the guy, see how. Well, it turns out that the guy that was supposed to come get us didn't come get us for almost 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And I found the loneliest man in the world to talk to who decided to tell me everything from what he thinks of the Cowboys to why he shouldn't carry a knife in Southern California or have a loaded gun when he's crossing the border from Texas to, you know, Arizona or wherever he was going, to Mexico. And this guy talked to me for 40 minutes, and I couldn't get away from him. And it's like, this is why I don't talk to people. He's a nice guy, very friendly, very cool, you know, funny, but I could hardly hear him because he was behind the glass booth and it was loud where we were. So I'm just doing the whole fake smile, fake laugh, nodding thing for 40 minutes, so much that I almost had whiplash by the time we got to actually meet the casino ops guy. So, yeah, this is me saying that I will never be social again on any more road trips. I'm just going to keep my mouth shut and stand there.
But we were more social the rest of the day because our listener, Mark Duvall, lives down there. He actually invited us to his home game, which was that night.
Yeah, we didn't make it. But
I thought we might be able to squeeze into the schedule, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
But that was pretty cool. But he actually drove out on his lunch break, and we went and had some hot dogs at the an outpost of the legendary Pink's.
Pink's.
And I got to say right now, I've heard about Pink's for a long time. And granted, this is not the original one. But I got a slaw dog, and I asked the nice little lady making my dog, hey, can you put some celery salt on that? And she said, oh, I'm sorry, we don't have celery salt. People ask about that all the time. So what I want to say, one, how legendary is this place? If they're not smart enough to put celery salt on a slaw dog, it's like milk and cornflakes, to be honest. And two, if people ask about it all the time, here's $5. Go down to the local Vons grocery store and buy a thing of celery salt.
Now, here's the funny thing. I really have to admit, I've never heard of it in my life. I've lived 41 years, and I never heard of celery salt in my life. That's saying something. I mean, you're like, celery salt? And I'm like, what the hell is celery salt? And you're like, what? Come on. And I'm like, really, what the hell is celery salt, and why is it so damn important? Is it like sea salt? I mean, I just don't get it. I don't know what the hell it is. I still don't know what it is because they didn't have it.
I know. I'm going to get you celery salt at some point. The first time you taste it, you're going to be a changed man.
Okay.
And, you know, we'll stop at McDonald's. You'll be like, ah, can I have celery salt on my burger? And then you're going to throw it a fit because they don't have it. It's that good.
All right. I'll take your word for it, but I've never heard of it or tasted it, obviously. So, or if I have tasted it, I didn't know I was tasting it. How's that? But, you know, Mark was really cool, and he brought us these card protectors that had our faces on them.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. Awesome. I was like, oh, my God.
Absolutely awesome.
I love that stuff, man. That's so cool.
All right, this was one of my favorite stops of the whole trip for reasons that had nothing to do really with poker, although the poker was great at this place. But we stopped at Barona, and it used to be called Barona Valley Ranch. And I love this. The manager said, yeah, I think they said decided it sounded too much like salad dressing.
Yeah.
So that was just called Barona. It's not even called Barona Valley, just Barona. And, you know, we pull in. And this little security guard out front, but he's not, you know, he doesn't have the big security guard outfit and stuff with the Billy Stick and badges, just an old guy with a big hat.
Yeah, big
and
hat.
He's waving to us.
Yep.
Welcome to the property. And I'm like, oh, that's great. It's one of those little touches that no one thinks about. And of course, we had this fight over whether he looked like Wilford Brimley or not, which I totally want, even though you're not quite with that. So I'm like, that's really nice. And so then we park, we walk inside, and we walk inside, and there's another guy. He hands us a glass of lemonade. As soon as we walk in, and I'm like, can I be anywhere nicer?
That was really
cool. People wave it to me. People give me free lemonade. And I guess in the winter, I guess they give you hot apple cider instead of lemonade. But, you know, it's to be honest, and I'm kind of joking around a little bit here, but to be serious, it's those little touches that I think don't cost a property much. I mean, how much does a tiny glass of lemonade cost, or how much does it cost to have a security guard who's sitting there anyhow wave to people? But those are the things that I think you talk about. I mean, here we are on the show talking. We're not talking about anybody else giving us lemonade
no.
on this trip. And I just think it's a real small thing that has big dividends for not just a casino resort, but any kind of business. And I really took a liking to it. And I like to see more people or more places treat you like that, because trust me, most people that walk in that place are leaving a lot more for Barona than Barona's given them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the nature of the casino business. So, and they also added an advertisement for free ATMs,
which is huge.
And absolutely. And I'm really bummed about this too, because we were traveling light and I just didn't think I could fit the ATM in my luggage. So I wasn't able to take advantage of that promotion, but, these people, they just give away everything there.
They didn't say the ATM was full of money, though. That was the thing. If we knew the ATM was full of money, we would have made space for it. Believe me. I'd have checked that bad boy. But we did meet Tim Malinowski. He's a young, motivated manager. Been there a long time, though. It's weird. Everybody we talked to looked young and had been at the property for 20 years. It was like, oh, my God, it's definitely something in the water out here.
Something in the air, yep.
He said that they had moved the room a few years back because it was pretty tight. He had said it was a tight room before, and now there's plenty of room. And it's near the food court, but it's separated from the casino, so it wasn't as loud as it could have been. It still wasn't as quiet as, say, as a walled-off room, but it was still much quieter and a nice place. Big board for all the games listed, and
massively big board.
Massive big board, and he was a great guy. And the thing I liked most about it was it was laid back. You know, the place itself is laid back. When you look at the place, you know, it's like you're going to a cotillion or something. You're going to this farm or whatever. But it was really cool, really laid back, not presumptuous at all. And then when you get to the room, he's the poker room manager. He's the boss, and he's got a golf shirt on.
Yeah,
you know, one of those sort of collared shirts that. And so it just had this feeling of, hey, we're relaxed here, we're easygoing, and it's a nice place to play, a nice friendly place to play. Not that when I go see a poker room manager, I don't want to see him in a shirt and tie or a suit or whatever.
Right.
But when they're dressed like I like to dress, I sort of feel like I can relate to them and a little better. And it felt nice and relaxed and welcoming. I liked it.
Absolutely. Well, moving on from there to Viejas. I like saying that. Viejas.
That's close. I don't know if you said it right, but that's close.
Probably not. But I like saying it that way.
Yeah.
So.
Viejas.
And it's actually, unlike a lot of these other places, right off the freeway, so it's pretty convenient to get to for the most part. And it's a resort that's gone through a lot of changes, really kind of working to kind of regain its place in the area. I mean, we went to a lot of places and they're like, oh, yeah, it used to be a great room, now it's not. And I think we kind of got that sense when we were there is, yeah, we realized that we need to kind of regain that glory, and they're working on it now. And it's up on the second floor, again, a glassed-off area, free casino noise. Third station right outside, by the way.
Yeah.
To the left.
Yeah.
You got some new promotions, obviously, to get some people in. And we talked about the Harris Rincon and how they rate you. I thought that was pretty cool. Here, they give you $2 an hour to comps. Fairly generous by any stretch of imagination. And then they give you $10 just for showing up for the day.
Yeah, was there a minimum on that?
You show up, your card, boom, $10.
So you know what? That's basically buying you lunch right there. You show up, want lunch, go play for an hour or so, and then go have lunch. I mean, if that's what it is, there's no real minimum, or if it's like an hour minimum, that's significant. That's pretty cool. Just showing up, $10. Man. Oh, and it also had those overs. Remember the overs that we saw in Mississippi?
Yeah.
It was unique because in Mississippi, it was during a limit game when you couldn't get any no-limit game going, so they would encourage the no-limit guys to sit in the limit game, and then if only the no-limit guys were remaining in a hand, they had these over buttons in front of them, they could play the hand out no-limit at that point.
Right.
But here, they had the overs, and it was like if you wanted to play higher limits, I guess, right? Was what it was?
To be honest, I really don't know. I should have pressed them more. I think we were just surprised to even see them.
Yeah.
We haven't seen it anywhere but Mississippi. And then we mentioned about limit, and I think the manager was like, wow, that's an interesting idea. Maybe we'll do it for a limit. So I guess I'm a little confused as to what it means for no limit. I mean,
I'm pretty sure it was like if you wanted to play bigger stakes or something. I don't know. I really can't remember.
But yeah, I mean, really, the only change is it's $2, $5 versus $1, $3 in the blinds, right? After that, all betting's no limit, so it's not like it's restricted at all. So, I don't know, I think when we go back, we need to press a little bit more on what exactly that deal was. But they do have overs there. So.
Yeah, they have overs, so that was pretty cool. Then we went to Sequan, that's where we ended up playing and having dinner, and it was a real active room. It just was recently renovated. I actually got to play stud 8. It was a 1-3 spread, though, so it was not exactly the stakes I wanted to play. But you know what? I just wanted to play the game. I'm so tired of not playing. You know, or having to play no limit, which is so weird considering where I started when this show started. But now, I was just happy to play it, and that was the game where I actually got to play with half-dollar coins. You know, it was like 50-cent pieces, real money. And when everyone anteed, it was the amount that they would pay the rake. So they took all the antes. There's no money in the middle. You're like, wait a minute, where'd the money go? It's the rake, and then you play. So it was kind of weird, but I won some money in that game. Not a lot, but I won some money. And you played in the tournament, I guess, just to pass the time because we were playing anyway. It was
it was
stop.
A $30 tournament. I mean, I had banked such a good profit on this trip already. I didn't want to. Not that I didn't want to lose. I mean, I could have played something else. They had 3-6, I think, was highest going there. So I'm like, yeah, I'll play a $30 tournament just to. I've been running good at tournaments, and of course, you can't say I've been running good at the tournaments and then enter a $30 tournament because it's not at all like the tournaments that you've been running good in.
All right.
Big go. But it was fun. They get a lot of people in there for them. And then I played a little 3-6 after there and watched Catching Hell without the words, without the sound. So. But I was just happy to see you happy playing.
I was happy to play. In the other rooms, I was like, ah. I mean, like I said, I played that stud game at Commerce, so that made me happy. But the other stuff didn't make me happy. I was like, I want to play stud 8. I thought coming here, I was going to be able to. It's the first time I got to play it and the only time I got to play it. So. I was happy with that. The other thing, too, is they have their World Series satellite qualifiers starting November 1st there, so in a couple of weeks. And it's, I think it's Tuesdays and Wednesdays. You might want to double-check with them, but I think they have some sort of qualifying system to try to win seats in the main event. So that's starting up again November 1st, so get on that if you're in that area and you want to play. Actually, it's kind of weird. We're wrapping up the portion of the show with Ocean's 11, but that was like the first place we visited on the whole trip.
Yeah.
But just because of the proximity of where we landed and everything and the way it was going. Sadly, no one was there. No one to talk to, I mean, official, which really didn't surprise me. It's funny, when you walk in the room and you're walking down toward the brush or toward the receptionist or whatever she is, at the end of the room, you can see that huge Ocean's 11 mural painted on the wall. And, but it's the original Ocean's 11, so you got to think Dean and Sammy, not Clooney and Pitt.
Yeah.
And it had all the guys on the wall, and you know, they commissioned somebody to paint it or whatever. So that was kind of cool. We heard the action was really good there. It's near Camp Pendleton, right? So that's that's always going to give you a lot of room, a lot of people in the room. And it's the largest room in San Diego, it says, or the San Diego area or whatever. So that was their big selling point on the sign. But we didn't get to play there because no one was there to talk to, and we had a busy schedule, and we weren't sure how busy we were going to be, and it was our first stop. But it was big. It was like split plan, right? There were a bunch of tables on one side.
Yeah,
and then,
right.
And that was where we first got the, holy cow, look at all these tables for tableside dining all lined up over here in rows. And it's so cool. They just, the wait staff comes over, grabs it, and rolls it right up next to you. And, you know, then every room was like that after that, but we didn't realize that was what we were going to see. So it was kind of cool. But you know, again, it was the first place we visited, so we weren't sure what to expect after that. So it was cool, and we moved on. But we ended up staying in San Diego, and this was pretty funny too. Scott's like, Motel 8? What the hell were we staying at?
I don't remember what it was, but I remember the planning of this. I mean, we're so busy on these trips. We're not looking for our 4-star accommodations here with pools, golf courses, and stuff that we're not going to use. We need a bed and a functional shower.
Yeah.
Sleep for like 6 hours and catch the next way too early flight that I booked us. but at the same time, you know, if there's a difference between two properties the same price, I try to look at the reviews. And this one actually was the most well-reviewed of all the places we stayed, other than, of course, the Crown Plaza at the Commerce. And I'm stretching to figure out why. Other than just price, we get there late, and we check in, and they have an elevator that takes us up to the third floor. It only goes 3 floors. But you pushed that button, and I literally think we were there an hour.
Yeah.
I thought we were going to miss our flight waiting to get to our hotel room. And until we have plenty of time to think about how long this elevator, how slow this elevator is. So I'm looking at the offerings in the vending machine right there, and I wasn't really hungry. And then I looked down, and what do I find? Tuna fish.
There's a tuna fish sandwich in the vending machine.
Like I don't know at all. I got just a block of tuna fish. In the vending machine. Now, I don't know. I don't eat tuna fish at all. It just doesn't seem like something. Oh, hey, yeah, I'm going to the vending machine. Can I get you anything? Yeah, I think it may be a Snickers. No, wait. Make it a tuna fish, please.
Wait, was it a sandwich or was it a block of tuna?
Was it like a case or some sort? Like a...
It was? I thought it was a sandwich.
No, it wasn't a sandwich. Oh. It's like, you know, kind of like you got the little foil over it, you open it up, and I guess you just...
Eat it.
Dry fingers in there and eat it. I don't know.
I guess if it's sealed properly, it's okay. It was not like it's going to give you some poisoning.
I'm not saying it's not okay. I mean, I obviously we're not in a third world country there. I'm sure it's okay. I just to me, it's more just, huh.
Yeah.
No, tuna fish. That sounds like a good choice to get out of this vending machine. That will satisfy my cravings for food tonight.
Oh, man. That is probably one of the most odd things I have ever heard of being in a vending machine. I mean, I've come from bowling alleys my whole life when I was a kid. Yeah, there's some weird stuff in those vending machines. But tuna, a block of tuna. Oh, man. I couldn't believe it. I thought you were joking. Then I saw it. And I was like, oh, I thought it was a sandwich, though. I wouldn't know it was a... Oh, man. Well, anyway, it was a good trip. And next week we'll do Northern California, which was another really good trip. And Scott, of course, got to use his hard hat. So looking forward to that. But right now, let's move on to our hand of the week.
This is Daniel Negreanu of FullContactPoker.com. You're listening to Ante Up.
Okay, we got another situation this week. And this I really like, actually. We have this listener, Ryan Gibbs, and... he's been a lot of fun lately. He's just really excited. He won this seat into the qualifier for the Heartland Poker Tour. And this has really been the highlight of his poker career. And I love it because you can just see how excited he is about this.
Yeah.
By the time he won it, and he wrote in asking for advice on how to play it and what he should do. And then if he got lucky enough to qualify to the actual main event, what to do then. So, I mean, this is really, to me, the epitome of this show. And what we've always done is just people getting excited about the game of poker, right?
Yep, absolutely. And it's great to have that kind of enthusiasm. And, you know, someone just, you know, we have so many people who listen to the show who are experienced now. In the old days, it wasn't like that. And so now to find fresh voices again and fresh people who are real excited about the game and learning and stuff and experiencing these things for the first time is really kind of cool. And I'm looking forward to helping them through this situation here.
Yeah, so he obviously got to play in this $360 qualifier for the main event, and I think he had to be in the top 20%, and you got a seat in the main event. And he says, unfortunately, he didn't make it, but he did have fun, and he thinks he played pretty well overall. So again, I mean, just warms my heart. You know, just having fun.
Yeah, and he got in for a fraction of the cost too, so that's more. You know,
and of course, he plays a lot of these bar leagues, and he went on to say the play in this thing was way better than that crap bar league poker I've been playing so often.
Yeah,
obviously, I mean, I knew he knew that going in, but and I'm sure he enjoyed playing against better players then too as well. But he gave us a couple situations here towards the end of the tournament and wanted to know what we would have done, and these are three hands within the span of five hands. All right.
Okay.
So they're almost rapid fire, one after the other, but not completely right after the other. So he sets it up a little bit. He says the play was overall pretty tight, mostly solid players, and a lot of pots won before the flop with the first in. All the hands below were within about 10 minutes of each other at the end of level 7, which is 500, 1,000, and a 200 ante. Ryan says he had been folding a lot, but so had everyone else. He had stolen about one pot per orbit to stay just about even, but I only had about 11 before this first situation. Nine at the table.
I think we lost you a little bit there. So it was 11,000 in chips he had, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. 11,000 in chips before situation one, the first hand we're going to talk about here.
Okay.
And they're playing nine-handed.
Okay, nine-handed. We have 11,000 chips, and here's the first situation.
Yep. All right, he's in late position. Five limpers to him. The pot is squiggly 8,300. He looks down at 4-4. Do you fold, call, or shove, he asks.
Okay. It's a lot of dead money in this pot, so there might be you might be itching to shove here just because you might be able to take all that dead money and not have to have a showdown or a race. But I'm folding. The blinds are 5 and 1 with a 200 ante. So that means you're paying... It was 9-handed, so that's 18, 28... That's 3,300 a round. Your M is like 3. So, really, I want a hand that I'm shoving with first if I'm going to shove. I don't want to have 5 limpers who have pot odds to call me now. You know, if I shove my 11, there's... If it's already 83, it's 19,000 in there, and someone only has to call 7 to win 19... to call my shove, you know, and if they have a lot of chips, they might do that. So there's too many people in this pot, I think, to have to get through with a shove and just have 4-4 in my hand. So I'm folding.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting situation here because, people teach you, of course, if people are limping, they must know how to have a hand. And if you shove, then they should fold because they're worried about other people and the hand having it. To me, though, I think there's too many people limping here.
Yeah, that's what I was. Yeah,
I got to think somebody's got something, and we don't know the chip stacks for everyone else, but I would just be too worried that somebody's going to call. And of course, you know, at this point, somebody out there, I'm sure, is saying, "Hey, you got 11,000 left. It's a little bit more than 10 big blinds. Your M is less than that, obviously, because of the antes. You can't be picky. You got a pocket pair here. You know, it's go time." And obviously, I just don't play that way with my short stack ninja thing. But I do something I think that's a little unconventional here. I'm going to guess that other people are thinking like me and aren't going to try to take advantage of all these limpers. And it's going to cost me 1,000 to limp here. I'll still have 10 big blinds left. And with this many people in the pot, if I hit my set, I'm pretty sure I'm going to get paid off. And maybe paid off by a couple people. So I might be willing to put the 1,000 in and just call and see what happens.
I don't think I'm getting enough to call to hope to hit a set here. I couldn't risk.
We're talking implied odds here, and I don't want to get too much into that because we obviously always screw that up. But I mean, right now there's 1,500 in the pot plus five more. That's 6,500 in there, so it's a little bit more than 6-1 on what the pot's laying us already. Actually, it says 8,300 here. I wonder how that happened. Five limpers.
Well, you got the 200 ante from everyone. It's 18.
Oh, the antes. Yeah, actually. So, yeah. So, you already have a decent pot in there. But I'm talking more about if you hit it, somebody's probably going to hit something else in there, and then you can get that stack. Maybe a couple stacks. So, for 1,000, am I willing? Because here's the thing. I don't think there's going to be a difference on the next hand if I get a hand that I feel like shoving between me having 10,000 and me having 11,000. Now, you can't just keep calling 1,000 all the way down to 3. That's a big problem.
Yeah, I don't think of implied odds.
I think I could. I mean, so you would rather fold 4-4 here than to take a shot at a set.
Yeah, I don't think of implied odds preflop ever. I mean, I think of implied odds if I'm heads up with somebody and I can stack somebody in a cash game. But when I have five limpers in there, I'm not thinking of implied odds all the way on a flop. I usually think of implied odds after the flop.
Usually, but I mean, just think of the situation here. We got... You have five people in there. What happens if you hit a set here? You don't think you're going to get paid off on it?
I don't know. It's possible, but that's not implied.
It's not implied. But what I'm talking about is I'm factoring not just on the money that's in the pot now. I'm factoring the fact that if I hit that hand, I'm going to get more. I mean, you can't count on that in a lot of situations.
I don't know. I'm not trying to be too mechanical either, you know. But when I think of I have 10 big blinds or an M of less than 4, I'm shoving or folding. And that's just the way it goes. I'm not calling to hope to hit an 8-1 set. You know, I have to get like 11, a lot of on my money to do that. And if it doesn't happen, then I'm stuck 1,000 when, you know, I'm just thinking, yeah, you're right, though, that you'll have 10,000. But now your M is like 3 exactly or something. So I don't know. I'm either folding or shoving here, and I'm not shoving. So... I'm not calling. I'm definitely not calling. It's just me. I play a little more to the
math.
It's
not just you. I think a lot of people would say. I mean, I guess this is kind of where I get the short stack nickname thing here because this is a situation where I would call and where most people would say, hey, I've only got, you know, 11,000 left. My M is this. In my mind, mechanically, I have to fold or shove, and I'm not going to shove, so I'm going to fold. Where I think if you step back and look at the situation a little differently, forget about that particular math a little bit, there's an opportunity here. I'm willing to risk 1,000 here. Not putting anything more in unless I hit my 4 or maybe it's open-ended or something. I don't know, like that. But because I really don't see a difference between 11K and 10K. Really don't see the difference between it in terms of the next hand when I have to shove.
Well, the other thing, too, that you really can't take into consideration because we don't know, but just because we're in a late position doesn't tell us anything. There could be a button behind us who has 70,000 in chips and can now shove, knowing that these five limpers aren't going to affect. And then you have the small and the big blind still behind you. So you have a lot of people left to act still. I don't want to just give up 1,000 for no reason, knowing that someone else can shove, and now I've got 10,000. Sure, you say that 1,000 is a lot, but that 1,000 will double to 2,000 if I get someone to call my all-in on a next hand. And 2,000 is another rotation around this table. So... I don't know, or close
yeah,
to
but
it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, but that's in terms of building your stack more. I'm talking more, do you have enough chips to make somebody fold? And at the 500,000 level, I would think there's no difference between 10,000 and 11,000. in making somebody fold. I mean, obviously, if you have 11,000, they call, and you win, that's two more thousand than you would have had if you played it my way. But I'm not worried about that so much. I'm worried right now about whether I can shove and pick up some blinds.
Yeah, see, I don't think like that. I'm not thinking about making people fold with my stack. I'm thinking about getting it in good and doubling up. I don't want to have somebody fold
wait,
and get
1,500. You can't wait for a good hand, though. I mean, you got to push and hope that...
right, but that's the whole point of the M. The M is telling you you have to wait for a good hand. You have the next hand that you're going to play has to be a shove. And I mean, I don't agree with trying to get someone to fold with 11,000. I'm trying to get someone to call me so I can double up or not go home, because I need to double up. I need some chips to get in this top 20%, and 1,000 to make somebody fold isn't going to do it. You're right. So what I'm hoping for then, since it's not going to make somebody fold either way, is to get as many chips as possible when I do double up. You know, it's just it's a different way of looking at it. You play a different way than I do. That's
oh, absolutely. I know. And yeah, I mean, that's why we talk about it.
Yeah. But I would have folded.
I would like people to think about it the way I do, not saying that they should play it that way, but I just think it's a weakness on some people's play, that thinking the way you're saying. But I am certainly the minority, so I'm not saying that you're wrong or anybody else is wrong. But all right, but anyhow, very next hand, he says, it's obvious what I did above because he has 9.8 left.
Right.
So he did my play, it looks like. It didn't work out. He's late position, 3 limpers this time. Pot is squiggly 6,300, and he has 3-3. Is the different is the situation any different here? Full color show.
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's almost exactly the same in that there are fewer limpers, but there's less in the pot, and you have a one rank lower pair. So I think I'm doing the same thing. I think I'm folding again. I really want to be the first one in, to be honest. And I know that I'm getting short, and I can't really, you know, count on that, but I don't want to go where I know I'm absolutely 100% racing, and if I only have 98 in the pot 63, someone's going to call me. You know what I mean? Someone's going to call, and all I have is 3-3.
Depends. I mean, again, you're right. I mean, we're at a disadvantage here, not knowing what the chip stacks are. I mean, if everybody's got the same stack as us, then it's less likely somebody's going to call us at that point if they limped in. When I initially saw this, I'm like, yeah, it's the same situation. But then the more I looked at it, I don't think it's the same. I don't think there's a lot different here, but the first situation, I was the 5 limpers is what got to me, because 5 limpers, I think there's somebody that's got something that's willing to call. They just weren't willing to commit something to it. I don't know if 3 changes this too much. I mean, if it's 2 limpers, I'm probably shoving here. 3 is on the borderline for me, I think, but I do think it's different than 5. And, of course, we're down 1,000 more, so, you know, now, you know, if I call here, if I do the play like last time I call here, then that leaves me with, you know, less than 9,000. Is that enough to shove? Personally, I don't think so, but you already thought the 11 wasn't enough, so, I don't know, it's a little different situation. I think at this point, though, I fold.
Well, it's definitely a different situation. I mean, but it's... It's not, again, too, now that it's one more hand later, you have more people behind you to act than fewer. So now there could be somebody behind you again who can call. You know, I mean, there's just so many things to take into consideration. And since we don't know everyone's stack around us and what they, I mean, I guess he told us what they kind of played like, but really, I just, it's so similar to the other situation with everything being adjusted to a little bit less that I would do the same thing and fold again.
All right, final little situation. This is 3 hands later, and he says, again, obvious what I did above, because he has 8.6K left now. Under the gun shoves for a squiggly 15,000, and we look down at 9-9. Next hand, the blinds are going up to 600, 1,200, 300 ante. I'm sorry, 5 minutes, blinds are going up 600,
minutes, yeah.
1,200, 300. Fold, call, or shove?
Shove. Now we've got one opponent.
Call, shove, same. Answer.
Yeah, exactly. They are the same answer. But I definitely shove or call, because we have one opponent. He's under the gun. If he had aces, why would he shove? You know what I mean? So he may have something like tens, but I doubt it. Even if he did, I don't think I can fold 9-9 there. I just can't fold 9-9. Plus, you know, they are going up very quickly, and now my stack is so small, I'm not folding 9-9. There's a huge difference between 9-9 and 3-3. With the amount of money we had. Yeah, it's huge. So, because people could be shoving with 5-5, 6-6, 7-7, 8-8 very easily there. Ace king, ace queen, you know what I mean? These other guys.
Oh, yeah, but ace king, ace queen is no difference whether you have 9-9 or 4-4. You still got a pair. They got
But I'm listing all of the hands, Scott.
I know, but it's only five hands different. 5-5, 6-6, 7-7, 8-8.
And 4-4 if you're doing a 3-3 hand.
If you're doing a 3-3.
Right. That's a lot. I don't think it's that big of a difference.
I really don't think it's that big of a difference. The call.
Hmm.
The shove, I would feel a little bit more.
But here's the other thing, though. Here's the other thing.
Like
you're not right, Scott. You're not right. There's also there are a bunch of hands that you're racing against with 3-3 that with 9-9 you're not. There's ace-8 that you're not racing against. You're only racing one card instead of two that would consider calling you. There's ace-7, ace-6, ace-5. There's a lot of cards in there too. Other hands that are changing the situation. Whereas ace-3, you're guaranteed almost to have two overs. So,
all right, now, but this guy's under the gun. He's shoving for 15K. I don't have to give him credit for a premium hand, obviously, because everybody gets short stacked here.
Right.
But I don't necessarily give him credit for shoving with an ace-8 or an ace-6 or something like that.
Well, you don't know. I mean, you don't know.
No, I don't know. I don't know. Poker would be a lot easier if I knew what my opponent's cards were.
Right, but if you're putting about any ace, if somebody's thinking pure M and they look at any ace and it's a hand to shove with and their M is, if they have 15... what are the blinds again?
That's another good discussion. I don't see a lot of people open shoving with any ace. Lately, I haven't. I mean, all these last couple tournaments I played, I just have not seen a lot of open shoving with any ace. I see a lot with ace jack, ace 10, ace queen, but I'm not seeing a lot of ace nines, ace fives, ace trays shoving, particularly from under the gun with 15K. When the blinds are 1,000. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. Obviously, people do it all the time, but...
Well, if I was desperate for chips, which
but
I think
I'm gonna,
15K
if I,
is...
analysis, I'm going to take those out of my opponent's range right there.
I don't know. I think a suited ace-8 might do that, depending how they play. I don't know. I mean, but anyway, I still think 9-9 is vastly more powerful than 3-3, regardless of there being only five hands between 3-3 and 9-9 that are pairs. Or 4 or 6 or whatever hands it is. So, I'm definitely just calling. I'm not folding this hand, especially with my stack going that low and what the situation is. 5 more minutes, my M's going to be almost nothing. So, I'm shoving.
Yeah, I think this is a whole. These three situations are a fascinating look into how you and I play very differently.
Yeah,
and probably how other players play differently than me too. To me, this is an easy fold. This guy's under the gun shoving. I want to be the first one in when I'm shoving. And if I'm going to call, and the guy's under the gun, and he's got 15K, I don't want to call off my chips with 9-9 here. I mean, I got another hand coming. I still get 8.6. It's 5 minutes left, so we're probably going to get two more hands, maybe even three, in at this level. And, I want to be the aggressor. And I would rather shove with something like 9-7 first to act on the next hand than I would to call 9-9 in this situation.
Wow. Yeah, it makes it even more remarkable that you went cash 10th on that tournament that we played. I just can't wait to see what everyone says about this.
I just think there's a tremendously amount more powerful when you're the first in.
Oh, no, I agree with that. I'm just saying, but 9-9 is... This guy is not shoving with 10s or better.
Overvaluing 9-9. It's just a pair, Chris.
It's just 10s. I'm telling you.
Here's the thing.
This guy's not shoving with 10s or better.
No,
I think he's shoving.
Best though, you're racing here. I mean, you're right. There might be some idiot playing ace 8 here. All right, fine. But for the most part, you're up against. I think you're up against a high ace here, and you're racing. And I don't want to call on a race necessarily here. I want to push and make somebody else call me on a race.
Well, you were going to do that with the other two hands when you had crap cards. You were
but that's
call,
different.
Call
those
in.
Are limpers. This guy's shoved. My stack is at risk here. When there's limpers, I'm putting them to a decision. Here, my only decision is, all right, here's my chips. Let's run it out and hope I win. To me, that's a massively different situation.
Well, let me ask you this. If you knew you were in a coin flip, where you knew they didn't have a pair that was better than nines, but there were two overcards no matter what they were, would you have shoved?
Shove? You mean call
I would call the shove. Yeah, call the shove.
No, I would not call
it. So if you knew that it was ace-king, you wouldn't have called all in?
No.
Yeah, see, that's the difference between me and you. I would call 100 times and twice on Sunday.
I'm just not a gambler. I would rather put somebody to a test. If I know, if he shows his hand, I'm like, am I going to coin flip? I'm playing poker. I'm playing a skill game here. I'm not playing, let's flip quarters.
Well, the skill is that knowing that 9-9 is actually a favorite to ace-king. It's not a coin flip.
A very thin one.
Right, but it's a favorite that you should take that edge when you have it, when you know that you have the edge.
Oh, man. Now you're getting to the whole... the forum people love you now. You're playing to the forum.
No, I'm not. I would definitely
you
call this show.
Pandering to the forum. Now.
I am not.
It's ridiculous.
I am not. If I had 9-9, I wouldn't even think twice about it.
The computer tells me that I am a 50.1 to 49.9%, and that means I'm the favorite. I have to take it all the time. No, you don't. Every situation is different.
Oh my God! I am definitely
every
not pandering
to anybody. And shove all your chips in. That is wrong. It's
no
just
way.
Wrong.
If I knew that I was racing and I had the pair and my tournament life with 8.6 and the blinds are going to 6-12-3 in about 5 minutes, and I've already folded two pairs and dwindled my stack down to 8-6, I am clearly getting it all in with 9-9 and hoping that it's a race. I mean, there is no way that you can convince me that the next hand's going to be better than 9-9, and I'm going to be the first in with.
I've got 5-6 hands at least, if not more.
Well, one, you don't know that. I mean, you don't know how many hands you're going to have in 5 minutes. It takes them to deal 5 minutes one hand sometimes.
Sometimes, but this guy's shoved. If I fold here, it's probably going to fold around, and then we're going to get another hand here in 20 seconds.
Yeah, I can't let this one go. 8-6 left.
I'm not asking you to let it go. I think, really, to be honest, this is a great discussion. This shows you two different styles of play.
No, I mean I can't let it go. Like I can't let go of the argument. I mean I can't let go of this hand. I have to. I can't fold that hand. If I'm folding that hand, I might as well not play. I mean that's a huge hand
to
me.
It's the wrong statement to say. I mean I think there's value in folding here, but I'm not saying you should or anybody else should. But to say somebody's wrong for doing this, I think is wrong.
Yeah, no, I mean, to me, it's just, it's mathematically, it's
should
the move
be playing. I mean, I'm playing, trust me, I'm playing. I am thinking about the situation, and I would rather shove, and I don't care that it's 9-9. You think 9-9 is much more valuable than I do, that's fine. I mean, that's great, but don't make me feel like I shouldn't be playing poker because I don't agree with you.
No, I mean me. I wouldn't play poker if I thought that every time I had a race I shouldn't play it. That's me. I'm not saying it's how you should play. I don't mean you shouldn't play. I'm saying that when I play poker, if I know I have the edge on someone on a hand, if I knew for sure that I was racing in this situation with the blinds going up and the money I have and the hands I've already let go, I have to make a call here. I can't let that hand go. I just can't do it. I just can't fold 9-9 there. It's different if it was, you know, under the gun raises and another guy shoves or something like that, but when you got one guy just open shoving, he also now has noticed that everyone is folding around him or limping around him,
very
and
true.
No one's willing to put money in. I'm putting his range a lot worse than 9-9, you know, and I couldn't let it go. So, you know, then if we fold here, we got to pay another 200, and we got to be in the blinds pretty soon because we've already been not on the button and then not on the button, and then three hands later, we got to be in the blinds soon now too. Right?
And I mean, the blinds are completely different when you get the short at that point.
Yeah, it's scary to know that the blinds got to become a next hand of the hand after.
But it's an inverse at that point. At that point, then, if everybody limps and I'm in the blind, then I feel like shoving. I shove with a wider range, then it's different. Because I don't have anybody act behind me at that point. So normally I don't like being in the blinds, but I think when you get short stacked, the blinds actually work into your favor.
Yeah, although, again, let's say it went up for some reason, like you folded and someone else called this guy and it took 5 minutes and the blinds went up. Now you've paid 1500 out of your 8-6 and the shove is not going to get anyone to fold, I don't think, at that point.
All right. I guess here's the other point here that I know people are missing, and they're going to miss it even though I mention it. When you have 8.6K left at 500,000 at 200, you got to get lucky.
Yeah.
All right. So, it sounds like I'm criticizing you for not wanting to call 9-9 because you had to get lucky on a coin flip. But you're going to have to get lucky somehow, right?
Yeah.
So, really, at this point, it's just deciding when you want to get lucky and how you can be luckier. So, I mean, I don't think there's really a wrong move here. But, I mean, I think what you're saying is then you're down another 1,000. Well, yeah, I'm still going to have to pick up a hand at some point. I'm going to have to win some kind of race, or I'm going to have to get lucky when I forced to call on the big blind with 4-3 at that point and spike a 3. Yeah, I mean, there's so much more luck involved at this point than anywhere else in the tournament. So, I just want to kind of control the luck a little bit more.
Well, let me ask you, though. That was the thing. To me, it sounds like it's the opposite of what you were saying before, though, in a way. Because you were telling me that if you knew that it was a race, wouldn't you want the luck on your side? You have the percentages on your side.
I want the luck on my side. I don't want a narrow percentage luck on my side. That's what I'm saying. I want to control the luck as much as I can.
But I thought that was controlling.
I was first to act. I am shoving all day long with this stack. All day long.
Right.
If somebody under the gun shoves, then he's taking away some of the luck from me. And if he's showing me his hand and I know it's a coin flip, it doesn't help too much. I'm flipping a coin there. I'd much rather blindly call with, I don't know, a suited 7-8 or something in the big blind than I would this situation. It's just a different kind of luck, I think.
I had no idea this situation hand was going to go this far with it. I didn't think that it was... I mean, to me, 9-9, which is an automatic call there with the situation that you're in. Obviously not in the beginning of the tournament when we're all big stacked and everything. There's something.
Right.
But in this situation, to me, it just seems like... and it also says squiggly 15K. So this guy could have like 13K, 12K, who knows. And then I have 8-6, and I'm getting...
I would think he's 14-9 to 15-1. Squiggly's not... It's not a big squiggly. It's a little squiggly.
All right, well, anyway, I just think that this is a good chance for me to get my money in with a good hand, a solid hand, with one opponent, likely. I don't think I'm going to get another guy to call after a shove and a shove. So... unless they wake up with a massive hand, but it's just weird. And I think of if I know this guy is ace king, I'm definitely calling. I just can't fold. I know I have the edge. I know I have, and the odds too that more aces and kings are out. I can't imagine letting that hand go in that situation. Other situations, obviously, I would let it go. But man, I don't know. It's interesting how we both think about how to play.
It is, isn't it?
Yep, it's remarkable. I mean, I would never consider calling in that 3-3 situation, and probably not in that 4-4 situation, and you would in the 4-4, and I don't remember what you said in the 3. You said you probably would fold in the 3.
3-3,
right?
Probably would have folded there. But I don't know. I might have called.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is how we look at the stacks, too.
Yeah.
You look at the stack as hoping people will fold when you shove. I look at it as I'm going to get can it make him fold?
You got two ways to win when you're the first shoving.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody can fold. You can pick up the blinds, which at this time, that gives you another orbit. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Or if somebody calls you, double up, then you got a little more breathing room.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do want somebody to call. Sometimes I'm fine with the blinds. But when you're calling in this situation, calling off all your chips, you can't hope that everybody folds and you pick up the blinds.
Right.
At this point, you need to win.
Right.
So you're taking one of your two options away. So that's the big difference. I'm losing a little bit of that, regardless of what maybe the other odds and stuff that are at play in. I just want to be the aggressor.
Very cool. Very cool. I had no idea this thing was going to go that long and be that situation. That was pretty incredible. It's good talk. just, like I said, a real good difference between the way we play or what we think sometimes at the table. And they're both effective. I mean, we both cash enough that it's our own way, our own styles work for us. So no swag, though. Sorry, buddy.
Yep. But everybody else, send your hands of the week or situations or anything else to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we may send you an uncut sheet of J-Design playing cards, official playing cards of Antiup. And remember, you can only win the uncut sheets, but you can buy the cards in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
All right, don't forget, next week, Northern California. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Antiup is a production of antiupmagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@antiupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.